All right, we will call this meeting to order. My name is Paul Sterren, and I am the Chair of the Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee. Can we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Sterren?
Here.
Mr. Skaggs?
Yes, present.
Mr. Smith?
Present.
Mr. Elson? Mr. Koletka? Hey, we have a quorum.
Thank you. And now our call to the public. Members of the public may address the committee during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes, pursuant to ARS 38431. The committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public, unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Do we have any members of the public here with us today? So we recognize David Swartz here in person, and he may partake in some further discussion about items that are agendized. Anyone else, Kurt, that we have with us?
No one from the public has asked staff, told staff they're going to be present for this part of the agenda.
Do we have anybody?
Yeah, Dylan Buknovich is online, but I'm not sure if he wants to speak.
And I'm sorry, how many folks do we have online?
We have Dylan Buknovich online right now.
Great. Very good. Thank you. Hearing nothing else then from the call to the public, we are at the adoption of the minutes. So these are the minutes of the April 12th meeting, our previous gathering. And at this point, I would entertain a motion to accept the minutes.
I make a motion to accept the minutes. That's T.
Was it April 12th or that one?
I'm not sure, but do we have a second
I think he's wanting to make sure the date's right.
Right.
Okay, my bad. Yeah, I see it's the 12th. I don't know if it's taken
So do we have a second to the motion?
Yes. I understand. Second to the motion.
Thank you, Roger and Keith. Any discussion on those minutes from April 12th? Any changes? Discussion? Pretty clean. Nothing else. Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of April 12th, please say aye.
Aye.
And all those opposed? And motion passes. We are on to our discussion items here. And on item 5A, public and committee comments regarding proposed rule changes. Just looking at our whole agenda here for a moment and seeing if it makes sense to do any kind of shuffling. But for right now, let's go ahead, I think, with discussion on 5A. With the caution, I don't want to take the whole meeting discussing this. We have other important things to do and on our agenda here. And also, Scott, from your end of things, how much time would you like on the agenda today?
Well, I'm a lawyer, so
don't give me time.
Yeah, and anything from up to 4 hours, but likely about 15 minutes maximum, 10 minutes easily.
Excellent. Thank you, Scott. Don't want to miss out on getting the full review of what you have to impart to us. So let's go ahead with our discussion and commence this on the proposed changes to the home inspector's standards of practice. We are at the tail end of a 90-day public comment period, and thank you folks for agreeing to the 90-day. I think it served us well, and we know we always have a flurry of activity, it seems, towards the end. And I also want to thank the BTR for their outreach, both with mailings and emailing, to try to get the word out. I think we did the best we could, and along with Roger's help with the ASHI chapter, to get word out about these changes and the proposed changes. We received, I think, kind of an expected amount of feedback, I would think, from our 950 inspectors in the state. I wasn't really expecting a waterfall of info, but I wasn't expecting crickets either, especially from an opinionated group like home inspectors. So I think we got some really good feedback and some good input. Some we may take to heart more than others, but I thought there was some very good feedback. Technically, there is a couple weeks more of the public comment period. That being the case, along with we have a new member of this committee that I haven't even had the chance to speak with directly of late, John Elson. I don't want to finalize any of the changes on the SOPs today at this meeting. I'd like to discuss them, and we may be able to separate the wheat from the chaff a little bit as far as what makes sense to consider, if anything, since we know these current standards have been approved for at least where they're at this point in time. From a timing standpoint, I guess I am back to staff to check on if we decide to have simple discussions on these and we try to finalize changes along with these topics and whatever else might come in on the next couple weeks, and we decide to maybe meet in a October-November time frame to finalize these, how would that work with the rest of the timing of this legislative process?
I sent an email to Rhonda Pascal at SOS kind of just asking what is the time frame. I know our docket was published January 2nd of 2023, so that usually gives you a year to do what you need to do. SOS being the Secretary of State. But I want to ask for clarification to make sure, is January 2nd, 2024, like, do we have to have everything complete, like the whole package finalized and everything by that date? And I'm just going to wait for her answer on that, but just so you know, the 1 year mark is January 2nd.
Okay, so that still could work well within any final tweaks we want to make on these from a timing standpoint, especially if we decide at the end of the meeting for our next meeting to be by November, by mid-November, maybe before Thanksgiving, we get nailed down final changes, we would for any final feedback, and then assuming if there's changes, then there would have to be, I'm afraid, a supplemental rule package. Is that correct?
Correct. If I would say the things that had to be concerned is that you guys in this committee would have to finalize whatever language. You would have to go back to AZ ASHI for them to adopt it. That would have to go into the supplemental rule package, which must have a 30-day minimum comment period. And then after that, it would then proceed.
So I don't know if you want to wait until November to meet again. And I would also look to Roger on any potential problems with meeting with AZ ASHI with any proposed changes, you know, as far as a timeline, because it's getting into the holiday time of year, would it be difficult to get with ASHI and, you know, approve changes kind of quickly by what? I'm just saying, I mean, it would have to be approved by ASHI before we had our last 30-day comment period.
Yeah, it has to be, because the supplemental rule package is going to refer to whatever AZ ASHI standards have been adopted by AZ ASHI. So they have to do that first. We have to know that specific date, that specific draft that's been adopted by AZSU, so we can put it into the supplemental rule package. That has to happen first.
Yeah, I'm going to be able to, you know, run that through, because it's a board decision.
Pull it down.
Yeah, it's a board decision. And it's not a commission decision, so it's a lot easier to schedule a meeting than a vote.
And just to be clear, this is really any changes, even if it's a wordsmithing change. Is that correct?
That is correct. Anything that's different between the current proposed rulemaking, if there's any changes made to it, it is supplemental.
All right, thank you. So that being the case, it kind of sets the tone we're going to, we'll need to meet sooner versus later so that we don't get jammed up on our January time frame. But if the Secretary of State gets back with any other information, you know, that we should know about, please let me know, Kurt.
Will do.
And just going through our information here. So let's go ahead and start looking at feedback that we received on these standards. And I guess what I'll ask of Roger, if you could just take some notes for what might be worthy of considered changes. In other words, what from our discussions here, just if you could just please note what may be of worth for us to consider changing or not. If you could just help us kind of track that a little bit. And that would be helpful.
Okay, can we start with the Arizona chapter of ASHI?
Absolutely. Please go right ahead.
So what happened here is that on November 14, 2022, they accepted the 2.3 of the home inspection standards that we had drafted at that moment. 2 weeks later, there was something that came up. So we ran another version through, which was 2.4. And that did not get on to the packet submitted to the board. So the board sees version 2.3. Supposed to have 2.5, I guess, is going to be the next version anyway. But that's what happened. Is it submitted the old version 2.3 instead of 2.4. So the dates are different. There's one thing that changed on 3.2b. The clarification on the title.
Yeah, thank you, and again, thank you for making, you know, that alteration, because that was a real important one. It had to do with the BTRS jurisdiction, so that was the only change from that latest one, and that was the reason for the letter and inclusion in the packet, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, Roger, did you have anything else on at least that one item you wanted to share?
I believe Mr. Schwartz, he mentioned that same thing. Are we going to need to make a vote on this or just accept it as written? What do we need?
I don't believe from a committee standpoint we need to do anything on it. This was an alteration made at the SOP level with the chapter that was done, and it has all been submitted at this latest version, I think, as part of the rule package, as I knew.
Let me make some clarifications here. So in November, AZ actually adopted the November. This committee discussed adding the 4 units. That was it. December version. Okay. When staff was given it and we gave it over to our draftsman, our rules draftsman, what was given to our rules draftsman was the November draft version. And so that went through that process over many months of her looking at that, and then it came back, and then basically what it came down to was that the December draft that was adopted by AZ didn't go before her and got went through the cracks. And so what we have is the rule package has the version 2.3, not the version 2.4. We didn't think at the time that was my mistake. Basically, it's the organization of that specific folder that I have about what's the most up-to-date information. Going through that process just didn't dawn on us the December version, because again, it's that one sentence difference that had gone through. However, we assume that there was going to be a supplemental regardless.
I'm going to say our mistake, not that's definitely an our mistake. But again, I whether I should have assumed this or not, I did assume that there would be additional changes, just knowing, you know, how things usually go. So
no,
I
knowing all this stuff.
I didn't say that, but okay. Thank you, Roger. So I figured, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of the comment period, after all was said and done, that it was a very high probability that something would be going back to AZ Ashi and we'd be looking at a new date anyway. So.
Go right ahead, Kirk.
And I would say at this time, what the committee can just talk about is, what do you want in the final SOP? Do you want the language of 2.3, 2.4? I think you have differing opinions on this language. I think Mr. Lee's comments were, he didn't find any issues with how it is right now, but maybe you guys believe otherwise. It would just be like the chairman had said, chaffing the wheat here. What do you want it to look like? And you can start making that discussion now before the next meeting, just so you can highlight what things do we need to ignore today and what things do we need to talk about at a later time.
Yeah, and that's kind of that kind of list, Roger, that I was kind of referring to. What do we need to look at again? What's still on the table, and what do we not even? In other words, what items specifically will be in this next version that we now know will happen for sure? The good news is, Roger, the chapter already approved 3.2b. Obviously the chapter 3.1.2b has already been approved.
By the chapter, the board has not seen it.
Okay. But now I understand why this is in where it is. Thank you, Kurt. And so just clarifying, this 3.1 Baker item in general limitations was not included in the package, but it will be in the next supplemental package along with whatever else, if anything, that we have.
It can't be. It's up to you guys what you want. From the feedback, you can do whatever you like with that.
Right. Okay. Thank you. So I'd like to spend about an hour or so discussing some of these and then see where we're at on the agenda, because I don't want to lose some of the other important items here. So let's just take on this one item on 3.1. Baker. These standards are applicable to completed buildings as a single-family dwelling and individual dwelling units in a multi-unit building, along with their garages or carports. Roger, we've gone back and forth on this wording. I still like it. It is really important, I think, for us to have this change in. As we discovered, without the change, the BTR has no jurisdiction for inspection of multi-unit housing units. There's no jurisdiction for the BTR to inspect high-rise buildings without this clause in there. And obviously, I realized that was never the intention of the law when it was written to limit that. But I feel strongly that we need to have it in there. Any discussions on any other wording considerations?
So what are you saying? You're saying,
I'm kind of confused.
Yeah, I'll give you, just to be clear on this, the way this came up to us got back to our 30 parallels. And so when, in the early years, it was just any address that got included was accepted. And now, of more recent years, Every address is checked, and at some point there was a question back to the Attorney General's office on whether a high-rise condo, if you will, an inspection in a high-rise building for one unit, is within our scope. And it was decided that it was not because of the wording in this item. So therefore, no high-rise condo inspections. When we're not doing a whole building, just one unit, no high-rise condo inspections could be included as one of the 30 parallels. Therefore, was also not part of the BTR's jurisdiction, as I understand. That's why we made the change. It was understood that the intent of the law was that if someone wants a home inspection on a single unit in a large high-rise building in Biltmore, they could have it done professionally by a professional certified home inspector and have the BTR's regulation and jurisdiction to support them. That was the whole idea of the law. But technically, it didn't get wordsmithed perfectly back in 2000 or 2001. And so we're trying to fix this oversight with the revised wording to make sure that those high-rise units are included in the BTR and then, therefore, can in the future be added to a parallel inspector's law.
If I could, I want to make a clarification too, is that in board statute, the definition of a home inspection, which is 32-101-17, the inspection, let me just read it, means a visual analysis for the purpose of providing a professional opinion of the building, any reasonably accessible installed components, and the operation of the building systems, including the controls normally operated by the owner, for the following components of a residential building of 4 units or less.
Yeah.
So the statute's where that line is drawn. I think what they're trying to do in the SOP, because again, this whole discussion, this was back in November of last year, and I think I'm kind of hazy even about from a year ago about that language. I'm looking at, make sure I'm going to get the right one, 2.4. These standards are applicable to completed buildings as a single-family dwelling and individual dwelling units in multi-unit building, along with the garages or carports. I would say that adoption in the SOP doesn't get around the statute of the 4 units or less, but I think it clarifies that you can look at an individual unit in a building of 4 units or less. But if the statute were to change in the future, where the 4 units or less were to be removed, this SOP would be kind of ready to go for if you wanted to go beyond that.
There is one thing I probably should point out at this point. Rules can never expand the board's jurisdiction. The jurisdiction will be set by the statute. Rules can clarify the statutes, but they wouldn't be able to give jurisdiction where jurisdiction wasn't given by the statute.
So I guess the real question is, if this change went through as it is proposed, would we then be allowing high-rise condo addresses as part of the 30 parallels, since it would then be in our SOPs?
I would say that the statute says 4 units or less, so that would either be the change. If it's a condominium with a building of more than 4 units, the SOP wouldn't go beyond the, or go above the statute.
That would be an accurate read of the statute. However, the committee could not give an advisory opinion regarding interpretation of the statute, but that would be an accurate read, certainly.
I guess my point is, why do we want to have parallels in a multi-unit complex anyway? I mean, this has all been resolved, 4 units, that's our statute. I don't understand.
Yeah, I think I'm, frankly, I'm a little more concerned with the BTR's jurisdiction over home inspection versus exactly what gets on the parallel line. If someone is wrong on a high-rise home inspection, the BTR has no jurisdiction from near as we can tell.
That's correct.
That was never the intent of the law 23 years ago, never. And I believe I don't believe other states limit that in any similar way. So if we need to change it in statute, then maybe we need to look at that.
Well, what do we do for new build inspections? Is the BTR responsible for those?
If it's a complete, I'm talking
pre-drywall. I mean, there are certain inspections that aren't covered.
True. That is true. Yeah, and the standards were never meant to address construction inspections and that kind of thing. But the law and the standards were meant to address a final, completed, habitable living space. Right. That was the idea behind it, on behalf of the consumer. And so
is this for, you're thinking this is more for liability control, is what you're saying. This is why we're talking about this.
Well, I don't know about liability. I think we're here to help protect the home buying consumer in Arizona. And I'm thinking more about the home buying consumer. I'm buying that high-rise unit at the Biltmore, and they have a complaint, and it's not accepted here.
So you're saying that they don't even accept the complaint? If there's a home inspection, even though it specifically states that the high-rises don't apply, you're saying they can't do it?
So let me just clarify that. We accept every complaint that comes in, regardless of who, where, what, even if we have no jurisdiction, it all would go back to the board with whatever, saying we don't have jurisdiction or whatever. But in something like this, it would just go before the board. And, I mean, I'm not the legal counsel, but, I mean, if I was somebody else's legal counsel and it was the situation that Paul's describing, I think that there's something to be argued based on what's in the statute.
So have we seen this issue with a complaint? Because I think every inspector that does it uses their templates, does the same thing that they would anyway. So I mean, I'm not saying it's not.
Since I've been here, that's something that's come to the board, but that's, either here or there, I want to be here a couple of years.
Once this was kind of uncovered, just seemed like a little bit of a loophole for someone to perform something called a home inspection, not have to be licensed. We're not aware of any kind of rampant issues with people taking advantage of this, and that's not the purpose of it. I think it's more for consistency and continuity within our law to make sure it covers all habitable residential dwellings. And why exclude this one scenario? And so the definition of, Kurt, you read the definition of a home inspection from statute?
Correct.
Could you read that one more time, please?
Home inspection means a visual analysis for the purposes of providing a professional opinion of the building, any reasonably accessible installed components, and the operation of the building systems, including the controls normally operated by the owner, for the following components of a residential building of 4 units or less. This out the different components.
Are you sure the way that is written that the high-rise condo cannot be included in that? Are we sure 100%?
Ultimately, an interpretation of the statute would be made by the board, but as the board's counsel, the residential building of 4 units or less would seem to be relatively indicative and a necessary portion of that.
So if we're going to follow the ASHI standards, it's 4 or less.
No.
You sure? Because I thought it even stated in the ASHI 4 units or less. So now we've got to change all that too.
It is. No, it is not. Again, we're talking about a couple different things here. First of all, we're talking about how large of a multi-unit building can someone inspect the entire building of versus one single unit within a multi-unit building. And so they're two quite different things. The 4 units or less emanated from the the codes regarding residential dwellings. So if it's a fourplex, threeplex, duplex, it's all within the confines, and that's where that came from. What is not clear to me is the actual interpretation, though, Scott, and I know I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but this is really important. If we are just talking about the components, not the entire building, the components of a building that make up a habitable space, it would seem that it would still be applicable for a high-rise condo.
Well, two points. The one point, anytime, and this speaks to something that was mentioned a minute ago, anytime there is any divergence between AZ-ASHI standards and the board statutes, the board statutes will lose control. So regardless of what AZ-ASHI has in a standard, if it conflicts with a statute, it's not going to be applicable. In the current situation, under the definition of home inspection, it's for the following components of a residential building of 40 units or less, but that is within the definition of home inspection. So if you're looking at what constitutes a home inspection in Arizona, which is tied into the definition of home inspector, which means an individual who is certified pursuant to this chapter as a home inspector and who engages in the business of performing home inspections and writing home inspection reports. And the home inspection report definition is a written report that is prepared for compensation and is issued after a home inspection and then, et cetera, after that. The problem is everything ties back into the definition of home inspection, which then does specify of a residential building of 40 units or less. Now, in terms of interpreting that, that will ultimately be up to the board while looking at a specific situation. So where a complaint will come in regarding a high rise, the board will look at it, and the threshold question would be, do we have jurisdiction over this? So the first question would be then the board's application of the definition of home inspection to that situation. I can't tell you how it would be interpreted in any given situation, because that's a hypothetical situation, and a decision about the statute will be made by the board reviewing a specific set of circumstances that actually occurred to determine if the statute in effect at that time provides for jurisdiction for the board. So I can give rough advice regarding this, but the actual interpretation of it will be up to the board in place at the time the complaint comes in. I would caution, though, against going too far to remove the 4 units or less from the home inspection, simply because that is a necessary portion of the statement in the statute. But again, the ultimate interpretation would be up to the board.
So the interpretation is up to the board, not up to the Attorney General's office, is that it?
The Attorney General's office provides legal advice. The board is the body authorized by the legislature to regulate the industry and home inspections in Arizona.
So we'll get to you in a moment, David. So let's get back to, at some point there was the decision made to not accept certain addresses off of a 30 parallel log. And was that decision done at the Attorney General's office or at the BTR board's level, where we stopped accepting high-rise condos on our 30 parallel log?
That decision could not be made by the Attorney General's office. We provide legal advice, but we do not make any decisions for any boards.
That decision was made as an internal policy practice based on the definition in statute of what constitutes a home inspection.
Okay, so I'm continuing to dig down here to try to peel the onion back.
Can I interject one thing real quick, Paul, that might help you sleep better at night? So the LNR meeting, Laws and Rules Committee meeting that we had last December, the verbiage, recommended verbiage for a future legislation change, I can't see that far, Kurt, can you read it? Because it does change to completed dwelling, but read the whole thing.
Okay. So, home inspection means a visual analysis, blah, 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 for the following components of a completed dwelling. And these hit stricken residential building of 4 units or less.
think that's based on discussion that we had in these committee meetings.
And I'm not sure we really want to take the four dwelling out, because now you've got, there might be a tie of some kind of liability. If you're doing a full complex and you happen to miss something that could affect everybody else, I mean, I just don't know if that's something we want to get into.
I believe the single family dwelling within these SOPs, you know, addresses it right there. You know, in that case. But so, just to be clear, it was the BTR's opinion that a high-rise condo does not fall within the definition of a home inspection.
Correct.
And that's the reason you didn't want that, is you didn't want all 30 in a big high-rise. You wanted, you know, you got to have different properties and things like that. And I think that's very valuable for a parallel, to have different properties.
So, I agree with that statement, but that's just my personal opinion. You could essentially, I guess, have 30 parallel inspections that were all fourplexes, and I mean, I don't think that you get no residential, no, you know, single detached residential, I suppose. But.
I have a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'd like to hear from Mr. Schwartz. Go ahead, David.
Well, this is just an area that lacks clarity, which in the legal world is a nightmare, and everybody else is affected by it. So this, over the decades, we have gone back to the legislature with cleanup bill to clean up statute, and that's what's needed. So is there a bill intending to be run to that could be part of that process come January to be dropped? Do you guys plan on dropping the bill?
I don't know what the Halls and Rules Committee. I can tell you that, honestly, David, every different organization, I see organizations representing the different professions that this board oversees, they all have their individual wish list of legislative cleanup and improvement, things like that. So I don't know how to answer that question. But
well, just if you're going to run a bill, could we get this in? Is, you know, could we work on it hard and clarify this matter this year, or are we looking at, you know, 2025 session?
I would say possibly. I mean, I don't know for certain, and part of that would be finding a representative that is interested in sponsoring what you'd like sponsored.
Well, I don't mean an individual bill for our matters. I mean the board in general is going to the legislature next year. They're planning on it. We can tack our desires onto that. We don't have one in
right. So there are some higher priority issues that they're looking at. But again, this will go to the laws and rules, and what comes out of that ultimately, I'm a servant of the board, so I'll do what they want me to do.
I guess just for historic purposes, for the couple decades we've been licensed, we've just tacked on whatever we were doing with what the board was already going to the legislature with. You guys would line up the legislators to support it, and we would get things done. So just to give you that.
Thank you. I don't see, you know, any other clear path other than we're going to have to try to reword this to try to bring it, reword the definition of a home inspection to try to bring it to the point where staff is comfortable with the wording and is comfortable having this as part of the jurisdiction. It is not a real leap to say that if the BTR is not accepting parallel inspections for the high-rise condo of the Biltmore, they're not going to be able to legally accept any jurisdiction for it. It's all in or not. And so, and we're taking the lack of acceptance, you know, of that high-rise condo as the fact that the staff doesn't feel it's within the realm of the way the rule is currently written. So I'm leaning more towards Mr. Schwartz and saying that we're going to have to clean up the wording of this and include it in one of the rule packages.
So this isn't a rule package. This is a legislative statute change.
Sorry. Thank you for clarifying that. All right. That being the case, I'm going to bring, as far as a legislative statute, that piece of it is not, I don't want to start discussing that at this point in time, but we may, the next time we run a bill, we're going to have to clean this up. We're going to have to. I think it needs to be done. It should have been done 22 years ago, and we're kind of the stewards of this profession here, and so it will need to get done at some point, but I'm going to table that one component for now. For the actual SOPs, I'm recommending we leave the change in that had been approved, the most recent one, and I recommend we leave that in for now. To,
so leave 2.4 in
3.1 Baker. These standards are applicable to completed buildings as a single-family dwelling and individual dwelling units and multi-unit building along with their garages or carports. That was the most recent, right? That was in a package right
that's
under your
very
letter.
Very last one, Arizona Energy Board.
So, you know, I'm recommending unless someone can come up with better wording for that. We just heard that is superseded by the rule, by the law. But as far as our SOPs go, let's have them be as clear as possible. Right.
Someone mentioned, you know, preparing it for a change. Might have, should have, who knows? Preparing the SOPs for that change.
If the statute were to change in the future, the SOP would kind of be all ready to go. The SOP at 4 units or less, and then the statute changed to anything, that would obviously kind of contradict.
And I did look on ASHI standards of practice, the ones that are in effect right now, and I didn't see anything about 4 or less units. And, you know, it came from ASHI way back when.
Yeah, I don't know that it made the 2013 ASHI revision, frankly. I don't know that it made the most recent ASHI national 2013 changes. It may have
actually
taken
2014. More close.
I'm going to read it, the current definition, just so we have it here. These standards are applicable to buildings with 4 or less dwelling units and the garages or carports. That's the current standards.
Well, that's what was submitted to the board in the rule package.
Those are the absolute correct 2002 3.1B.
What was that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 2002, okay. Yes, that's correct.
Just making sure we understand that currently it's what it reads, and then whatever we do here, this is going to be the new language then. That's all.
All right, let's, if we're okay moving on a little bit here to further our standard discussion and to see, I don't want to necessarily hit everything, but I do ask for our committee members to make sure that they review everyone's feedback in detail if they have not already before we get together again. But I do want to broach a couple subjects here. I'm looking at in the package from Mr. Edward Padilla. Is he here by any chance?
No one is here for the items here. And I would like to say that the Edward Padilla, and there's another gentleman who made the same comment, they actually were commenting on the language within the, they weren't rule changes or the SOB, but actually language in the docket that was submitted to the Secretary of State, so they don't really matter. And if we do a supplemental, I can clean up that language before proposing it.
Yeah, I understand that they're not as germane to our discussion. Just moving on to Mr. Schwartz's recommendations. You recommended cleaning, we talked about 3.1 Baker, David, and I'm going to let you see if you've got any other feedback. So on the 5-2 Baker here that you, I thought there was some good comments as far as just rewording of that between doors and entry doors and windows, and kind of group the doors together. That seemed to make a lot of sense the more I looked at it. So, you know, Roger and Keith, I recommend you consider David's change here on 5-2 Baker. It's just a cleanup. It's not anything different. It doesn't change scope. It just makes it clear, right? So, yeah, 5-2 Baker. So right now it says, operate all entryway doors and a representative number of windows, including garage vehicle doors, manually or by using permanently installed controls of any garage door operator. And so David suggested we start the sentence with a representative number of windows and then address all the doors at the back end. And kind of, right now, doors are addressed in two different parts of a long sentence. Right. And so we're losing continuity there. So
it's just clumsy as it is.
So I recommend that, and if you
change
just,
it to that word.
Yeah, I recommend 5-2 Baker does get changed. And I don't know that we need to wordsmith the final change in Roger, but I let's, you know, do a final wordsmith on 5-2 Baker, please. Any other questions on that one? Comments? Moving on, David. So singular or plural on smoke alarms, we're at 81 Henry, 81H. We currently have Inspector shall observe the presence or absence of smoke alarms, and the question is, are we making an inference with the S that there should be more than one per domicile?
So you want parentheses?
Yeah, I guess the question is, I don't know if it's appropriate to put parentheses in a legal document like an SOP, but technically what we need is alarm with the S in the parentheses, so it could be singular or plural. Isn't that technically what we need to say? It could be a single alarm or multiple alarms, right? In other words, the way it's written now, we're inferring that there should be more than one.
If the intent is that all smoke alarms in the residence be checked, then you could simply say the presence or absence of all smoke alarms or any smoke alarm.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't see a big conflict in inferring that someone would think there has to be multiple ones. Could you elaborate a little bit, David?
Sure. Thank you. The last sentence there in the comments, do you have the comments there?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, it's just, I guess, you know, you can look at it. We're entering an area when it comes to smoke alarms that, you know, are we going to expect every home be up to current code requirements for smoke alarms? I would say no. So the thought was, I think we have to make sure each home has at least one smoke detector that operates, you know, and then we can all, each inspector can do as much analysis of that system as they want. They can exceed the standard, but they must at least verify there's one in that house properly placed that is operational. And that's my recommendation. So that you don't have to bridge the gap to how far do they have to go? Do they have to verify interconnectivity, the exact placement that's required today, you know, battery backup working. You know, you could go to the nth degree with these. So I'm recommending just verify one works and it's properly placed.
Right, the way it's written, it's just the presence or absence of smoke alarms.
I think the way it's written, it doesn't infer that there couldn't be a single one. Do you see a conflict with the way it's written, I guess?
Well, it's plural right now.
Right.
So right now it is. It's saying but there's going to be more than one you're checking for.
But it could also be saying there's not because it says absence.
Right. Hey, you're the one that wrote this. Come on.
What's that? Oh, in the beginning? No. There was a whole crew of folks.
Yeah. I think I'd like to ponder this one a little bit more because I'm not sure there's a conflict the way it is with an inference that there must be. We use plurals all through this water conditioning systems. You know, we're using plurals all through these SOPs.
Okay. It's not a hill to die on.
I don't think so.
So I think you're fine. Because you're right, that's true, what you just said.
Right. So maybe we're okay, and unless someone has any other heartburn on 81H. Let's look at the next one here. 81I as an item, the presence or absence of carbon monoxide alarms where applicable. So, yeah, we also had some other folks on the whole where applicable thing.
It should be when. It should be just when.
Meaning it's only applicable if there's fossil fuel present? Would that have to be further required?
Yeah, so
is that like an assumption? This is me from not being a home inspector, but it seems like we're just making an assumption there by saying when applicable.
Yeah, the when or where is a good question. Grammatically, I'm not sure what is the most appropriate word there.
You go where is it? Which way is this?
Could say if applicable to.
Well,
the reason some home inspectors take weird stands, in my opinion, and some would argue that if there's an attached garage, you know, you've got a vehicle there that could be left on and it can transfer to the house, and so every home should have one and this and that. So, you know, it was kind of a division between whether to specify when fossil fuel appliances are in the home. You know, you've got gas appliances in the home. That's a for sure. And then we're not going to take a stand on arguing about whether a vehicle could contaminate the building.
So that's the, you know, the challenge. How far do we go in these standards as we kind of creep in the code land a little bit, which we don't want to go into. There were some other suggestions from one or two other inspectors that we should actually detail where or when we are requiring the CO detectors. And I'm a little hesitant to do that because those standards might change. Right now, it's if there is gap fossil fuel in the home and if there's a fireplace or attached garage. But that could change, and so I'm hesitant to go into that level of detail on when we are requiring the presence of CO.
But whose standards, Paul, are you talking about? Again, I don't know, you know, so whose standards? Because it's not in here. So
it is the code. It's the International Residential Code, and while home inspectors are not code experts and never represent themselves as such, but our standard of care regarding safety emanates from the code because it's what we see being built. And so that's what we inspect to. And so we see these new standards that and 20 years ago, there weren't really this kind of requirement. The code has required this additional smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors, and the code requires it in those cases, but the code could change next year.
So it seems like to me, and I'm just going to throw my opinion out here, that it just needs to be like smoke detectors where you're reporting on the presence or absence of a carbon monoxide alarm, period. Or if you're going to reference, because again, we're assuming that the ICC code or IBC code, International Building Code?
IRC.
IRC code, residential. What's the R?
International Residential Code.
Residential Code. Okay. I don't know, Roger. Is that even appropriate, like for Ashley to say, talking about CO2 detectors, as because then you're referencing another code in the AZ-ASHI standards that we're incorporating. So I don't know. That seems odd.
That's why when is a perfect word.
Yeah, well, just one quick thing, Roger, and I want to get your comments. It really comes down to if we want the inspector to figure out when or where it's applicable, or we want to define it. That's really the question here.
But if you don't say when fossil fuel appliances are present in the home, boom, or something to say what it is, you can't just assume that it's or hold somebody to something that isn't in the standard or can be referenced.
And there is a parallel to, you're right, Judith, that's the way to handle this, because there's a parallel that we deal with right now, and that is when a vapor barrier is required. So what we chose to do when we were in this exact same position was, because certain areas of the state need a vapor barrier and some don't. You know, in Phoenix and Tucson and dry climate, lower elevation areas don't need a vapor barrier. What we chose to do is require the inspector just say whether it exists or not. You can go on with an extra sentence to say not required in this house, perhaps because, you know, you do not have fossil fuel appliances or whatever. You can explain, but the state does require you to say whether there's one present or not. That might be a great way to handle it.
David, you have Roger and then Scott, please. Roger, did you have anything else on this one?
I mean, it does say the absence or presence. Smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors as well. So we're just letting them know that they're there or they're not.
Right, but the where applicable, is the inspector supposed to figure it out themselves, or do you think we need to detail the whole fossil fuel and when they're applicable?
I think that it's going to change over the years as we move forward, so it's going to be different. Today versus, you know, 10 years from now, more than likely. So having that word of applicable, I think it's a great deal.
Scott, did you have anything on this?
Most of what I was going to say was actually put forward by Judy very eloquently. I would just recommend that when looking at something like this, the committee consider potential enforcement. And if you do have to enforce it, if you're taking somebody to court, if the question is whether or not they indicated the presence or absence of carbon monoxide alarm, that's a very easy binary to establish. As soon as you put in the term where or when applicable, then you do go down the rabbit hole of defined applicability, and that could change from time to time. That also gets into board interpretation at any given time as well, so that could become a moving target.
And it does put more responsibility on the home inspector to figure out if it's applicable or not in a given home.
So maybe we ought to take it. So now we're thinking maybe we ought to take that last two words out, right?
If we take it out, then we have to define the fossil fuels. I can't see.
Just say the like presence or absence of carbon monoxide.
And remove where applicable.
Yeah. I mean, you're thinking about this as a home inspector who knows what I'm thinking of it from a whole different angle. Where applicable. Let's argue all day about where it's applicable. And where does it say where's applicable? It doesn't say anywhere where's applicable. So I'll argue with you all day long that, you know, just not to be angry, but just to try to illustrate that you're assuming this is a given thing that is understandable and would be enforceable.
I think that's interesting. Okay. So let's consider removing where applicable. Does that address your concern, David, too?
I think that's the appropriate move.
Any other discussion on that one there? Making some notes, Roger.
I'm good with removing the where applicable. It's going to basically match H.
No, let's keep them separate. Thank you. Thanks for the thought. I think I'd like to keep them separate, even though they are combining Smokies and COs now. That's how they're selling them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that might be what we're faced with in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Another reason to not
is that all new homes
to not detail this.
Whether they have
fossil presence or absence. Presence or absence.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm kind of liking that. All right, let's move on. Let's move on here. Any other thoughts, David, on yours? You have more. hours, secondary fire egress. Here we go. Potential arguments will exist regarding whether a room is a bedroom or not. Definition for term bedroom. I thought we had bedroom defined somewhere. I thought it's not in glossary, but I thought there was a definition we used for a bedroom.
Maybe residential.
It meant to be a room meant for sleeping in a residential dwelling. A room meant for sleeping.
I don't know where it came from or where I got the idea in my head, but I always thought a bedroom had to have a built-in closet. Did that come from anywhere, or is that just urban legend? Oh.
Yeah, that's not a legal requirement for a bedroom. But the point is that it can't be a cot in the dining room. Then that's not a bedroom. A cot in the dining room is not a room that was meant to be a sleeping room. So...
If we encounter a vacant home and there's like a den or an office that is really a flex room, right? Mm-hmm. So then
we have to assume it's a bedroom, right? Like we usually do, right, David? We have to assume it's a bedroom, right?
I guess. You know, it's just the board will have to deal with that. It's the only thing. If in fact you don't have to have a built-in closet like the appraisers always seem to standardize.
So where do the appraisers get that? I wonder, does real estate, do they have a different set of definitions for, or maybe we could do a little homework on appraisers and...
It is a historic. I don't know if they still do it.
It's a traditional bedroom requirement. No. Of course, in England, it was a piece of furniture, and then over here, then they started building them in, but it's never been a legal requirement as far as the codes of the municipalities. They're there, but there's no requirements. But when we don't see a bedroom, we think, oh, it's probably a study. We home inspectors might refer to it as probably a study, but we see a lot of studies with closets, and so home inspectors don't want to have to guess whether or not it's a bedroom and how they should inspect it. If it looks and smells like one, they have to understand that it could be used as one. If it's a study, that could be... Unless it's open, but if it's got a door on it and it's a study and it doesn't have a closet, and we have to assume that it could be used as a bedroom. And I'll tell you, the listing agent is assuming it can be used as a bedroom when they're advertising it as a 3-bedroom or 4-bedroom. Which way is the listing agent going to go? So, therefore, we're on 11-2 Charlie right now, Roger. 11-2 Charlie, Inspector Shell, report the absence of secondary fire egress from bedrooms.
So maybe just leave it as is.
I'm thinking of leaving it as is unless we can think. The word bedroom would still come down to the dictionary definition because that's not defined in the law anywhere. But it would still come down to Webster's dictionary on what a bedroom is, right?
What if it was in the standard of practice? What if it was added to the standard of practice glossary, Ashy's glossary?
Well, we could add it to our glossary, I guess, is the point. We could add it to definitions ourselves, right? And one of the other pieces of feedback was to actually do that, to define bedroom.
I don't know that you can because, you know, I've actually owned a cabin near where I kind of live up north now that was a 3-bedroom, not one built-in closet. They were all armoires that transferred with the home, you know. So anyway, we deal with this when we decide if it's a bedroom but it leads to another room. So egress-wise, you have to go through another room. So we have to sort this out anyway right now, right? And I don't know that there's any definition that's going to exist to draw from.
I think, for lack of something better, I recommend we just leave it as it is right now.
I think the important thing here is to be able to open a window if you have to get out. You know, you go to these where they have the bars and you can't get out. They need to be able to open it from the inside upstairs. They've got to have a way to get out there.
Yeah, and there was another suggestion later on in the packet that said on this specific item that we should just simply say that a window or a properly sized window or door is required in every bedroom. And that's the other one.
That's an instruction.
But
that's
I know.
Properly sized.
Yeah, Right.
I think it's good the way it is.
Yeah, I think let's leave it as it is. Any other discussion on that one?
Just to bring up one thing, just
yep.
What about the word, the term sleeping instead of bed?
I'm not sure how that changes anything.
None of it, it's just two different. It's a different one. Sleeping room and bed. Because you can sleep in a room without a bed.
I sleep in my office sometimes.
Oh, so do I.
All right.
We go 3 hours later.
But not when I'm reading the standards of practice, though. So let's move on.
Paul, make a quick comment. The definition of the secondary fire egress does mention bedrooms. Does it need to be mentioned in C? Can we report absence of secondary fire egresses? You look at secondary fire egresses. Is the definition of the glossary where bedrooms are mentioned?
All right, so let's look at that. That's a good point. Secondary fire egress is defined in our glossary as openings such as doors or windows that allow direct access to the exterior of the structure from the bedrooms.
There you go. It's worth it.
Yeah, it sure does clarify that, doesn't it?
And I just, you mentioned Webster, and I just looked that up, and it says the primary definition here is a room furnished with a bed and intended primarily for sleeping. So legally, perhaps, the argument would be, would center around, was there a bed in it when you were there? If it was vacant, now you've got to use your best judgment. But if you were there and there was a bed in it, you're going to carry the ball on liability, probably.
And I think the inspector should. I think that's appropriate, actually. When there's a bed there, we need to be on high alert. Somebody's sleeping here, and do we have safety concerns with this, or are we okay with it? Right, that's one of the many calls the home inspector has to make, and sometimes they're tough calls. So yeah, thanks for referring back to the glossary. Thank you. All right, so I think we're good on that. Let's move along. Alan Shelton had a couple good comments. Our buddy Alan. He's done a lot of expert witness stuff. He's a pretty sharp guy, and his biggest concern was the whole tossing out the immediate major repairs. And as I recall that discussion, the idea was it's a call or it's not a call. It's a defect or it's not a defect. And it's if the inspector wants to report something that maybe needs to be monitored because it may not fail now but may appreciably worsen in the future, then it's either a call or it's not a call. It was too much of a gray area, frankly, and that's why it got removed. And so I'm not inclined to go back to the immediate major repairs, and the question is, back on definitions, if it is appropriate to do anything with the definition of major defect. Currently, major defect says a system or component that is unsafe or the primary function is not working properly. So the primary function is not working properly. So we got into some of these other discussions where if we've got an air handler and it's functioning, but it's making a noise, well, it wasn't an immediate major defect, but it was a call because it was something that was going to appreciably worsen. But we felt in that scenario, it would still be an adverse condition inspector knew about, that they should be reporting on, that it was a noisy air handler. AC is working great, but it's a noisy air handler. And it's still an adverse condition that the inspector needs to know. And you know, like many things, it can be subjective. But any discussions on the definition for major defect or the concern of the person that responded? Just further damage be a serious harm?
What is Peter's name? He was involved in writing this.
I have not quite read all of Peter's comments yet, but Peter's probably listening in, and I hope he is. Go ahead and read that, please.
All right, he says, consider adding, as well as conditions that may worsen appreciably, cause further damage or and or be serious hazards to health and or personal safety to the definition of major defect.
Same change.
Combine the two is what he's doing.
Okay. That's a big change there. That's a big umbrella to add that kind of wording to it.
I don't understand the whole reason. Well, you guys, I wasn't involved in this, but I attended meetings, but I'm not sure why you wanted this reduced in the first place. What was the most, why did we want to remove this immediate major?
I'm trying to think back on some of the discussion. I know it was only used in a couple scenarios where we used major defect more, and immediate major repair was found to not really be serving our standards because it just seemed to get too nebulous in having the inspector make a call. And the term immediate was confusing. What the heck is immediate? It was too nebulous. And trying to enforce the term immediate in the standards doesn't seem like it was the right thing. So we didn't like the word immediate anyway in there.
Yeah, during the process, I kind of analyzed the ASHI standards from, I think, 04 was the most recent 05, 04, and then the current InterNACHI standards, and they had both kind of gone in the direction of major defect, period. The word immediate does nothing but create a potential confusion and higher bar that is strangely going to harm you in a legal situation potentially. So doesn't add anything to the customer's experience because a major defect's a major defect, you know, with or without the word immediate in front of it.
So, unless someone really has some strong thoughts about trying to change the definition.
Okay.
Thank you. Unless someone has some strong thoughts about changing that definition, let's consider it, but I'm not seeing where that's going to really serve us, and I don't...
Now that I look at it, too, I kind of like the word worsen appreciably, because we're doing that, you know, we're telling the customer we see something that is a probable future problem for you. However, you know, right in the beginning it says we do not have to predict the future of these components and stuff. So it's actually a conflict with some of the earlier requirements of a home inspector that are stated.
Yes, thank you. Okay, yeah. Anything else on that one item before we move on?
Well, I think we ought to really consider what Peter said on this, because I do think he's got some good verbiage in here if we're going to take away immediate major repair, because if there's something that's very dangerous there, you've got to be able to state it, like, immediately. You know, like an issue with gas or something.
Yeah, let's take a look at Peter's wording on it before the next meeting and see if we want to do something with it, guys. Serious hazards to health, personal safety. That's just a lot of nebulous words for me.
You can read what the definition of unsafe is. Does that tend to cover it, how we have it right now, in the current definition?
Current unsafe is a condition in a readily accessible installed system or component that is judged by the inspector to be a significant risk of serious bodily injury during normal day-to-day use. That's unsafe definition.
Not sense what that section or that comment line is referencing.
All right, well, but I'm a little concerned with putting all those words in there, but let's take a look at it and consider it before the next meeting. The last one on Alan's feedback had to do with correct or evaluate, monitor by evaluated by appropriate persons, and the wording on appropriate persons. And he also infers that the home inspector could be an appropriate person. Doesn't seem like the home inspector themselves could be an appropriate person.
If they're licensed. If they're licensed.
Within that discipline.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a can of worms right there. But I still kind of like the evaluation by appropriate persons. It's pretty clear. We're talking about the specialist here. We're talking about the doctor referring to the specialist. And is there any thoughts on that?
Do you think it makes any sense to use the word specialist? No, because it can be a generalist of some sort that has...
The idea is someone with the knowledge, someone with the appropriate knowledge. That's really what we're talking about. And that hopefully is clear by evaluate by appropriate persons. So I'm inclined to kind of leave it as it is unless we could figure something better. Okay. Moving on. We had some good feedback from a Mr. Cy Porter. Thank you, Mr. Porter. And I'm looking down. He recommends that we stay with the old standards. He had a concern with how they were presented by the BTR, poorly written changes. I'm just looking for... I'm just taking a look at the red lines, if there's any discussion items. We removed the requirement for probing because it was too nebulous when it's too subjective.
And destructive.
But you can always,
and destructive,
but
thank
you. Can
you.
Always do that too.
It does not keep
practice.
Correct. On the GFIs, it's not clear. We went around and around in GFCIs and AFCIs, and I'm pretty happy with where we are. We know those are requirements that, you know, can change 3 years with the National Electric Code, another code that we kind of try to follow for safety. As far as, is there any discussion on the AFCI, GFCI feedback from this gentleman? It's not clear, I guess, what he's proposing.
I wanted to give you a little feedback, too. Just, I did reach out to Mr. Porter, and he is kind of specializing in new home construction, so that's kind of the viewpoint, and he's very big on social media. So, you know, that's just how he's accumulating information. I tried to reach out to him with any concerns, and he did bring up the probing one, mostly almost to protect the home inspector, because if we probe and create damage, you can always say the state required me to. Look, it's right here, right? And that protects us to do our job properly, perhaps. You could make that argument that if we see something that's suspect, it's such a big area, you know, you're responsible for every inch of baseboard then in the house, you know, and it is destructive, and right up front it says we don't have to do anything destructive. So, you know, I didn't have full agreement on that. He didn't give me any other areas that you guys have, so I have none.
Thank you for feedback and for reaching out to him. And that was the other challenge is, it's always the question of the inspector, you're probing one area, where do you stop? And So, but it's still the inspector's judgment. We're just not requiring it. Moving on to COs, and this is where we recommended, this gentleman recommended we actually detail when they should be present versus where applicable. So the size of the stay there. And on the dismantling, remove covers. Let's look at that. Because we don't want to stipulate a requirement through omission. And as far as removing the dead covers on the panels, that is one that I think we should take a look at. Any thoughts on that from you guys initially here? So we have under 8 system electrical, the inspector shall observe. And this is coming off, the existing ones. And operation of readily accessible. So shall observe. And the interior of the panel, sub-panels is not included in shall observe, right?
Yeah, but you got to take it out.
Right, but it's not included in observe, but...
So you're talking about dead front?
Yeah,
so we're down to...
we do require that you describe or... The service entrance conductors. There's no way to do that.
Right. Well, that went out. But what I'm looking for is
have to remove the dead front cover to examine the service entrance conductors. Period. So you're going to be taking it off.
Well, that breaker side compatibility you got to do.
Yeah, I want to make sure we're being clear. We don't want to have any requirement by inference or by omission, if there's a better way to do it here. So it says 8.2, Charlie says, the inspector shall dismantle I'm reading from the what this gentleman copied, and it's not the whole standard, I don't think, the inspector shall. Dismantle any, the 8.2 Charlie meant dismantle any electrical. It's not required to dismantle any electrical device or control other than to remove covers of the main and sub-panels.
It's 3C, yeah.
Is it 3C? Okay, yeah. So that was not required to, right. So other than, so... So we're making a requirement as an other than.
Yeah.
And I know it's not very graceful, but we're requiring them to remove the covers in a not required section.
Yeah.
I think that's what we have here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is all in the ordinance.
And is it poorly worded that way? Should we fix it, or... It's working, and everybody knows what they're supposed to do, and it is clear in the standards, but it is under the shall not be required to observe.
I think it's worded properly.
Any other thoughts on this?
I think we have a little bit more.
Really good point, though, that he did make, and we know we're not testing smoke detectors. Accessories on fireplaces. I think we want to keep fireplace accessories on 9 Baker 2 generic because we find all kinds of stuff in fireplaces. I found an electrical outlet in a fireplace the other day. An electrical outlet, a functioning one. That's an accessory. It doesn't belong there. All right, that was the feedback there on interiors. I think we're good on kitchen appliances and modes. feel pretty good about where we're at with just the primary function of those. I think we kind of beat that horse a little bit, unless someone has any other thoughts. The bedroom discussion there on 11.2. All right, moving on.
I think that addressed most of them.
I think that really addressed a lot of the input, frankly, that we got. Any other important items that came in for possible changes that we have not discussed here?
Just Peter Leeds' comments that came in this morning. It was emailed to you, and you guys should have a printout if you wanted to go through that.
Yeah, thank you. So we discussed the four-unit component on where he was on the definition of a home inspection. Peter agreed with adjusting the wording on the windows and doors on 5-2 Baker. On the smoke detector, carbon monoxide, he kind of likes where applicable, right? Leave it where it was.
But after our discussion, I think we get that figured out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Clarify the presence or absence in dwellings having gas appliances, fireplaces, or attached garages. So Peter is in favor of detailing as the requirements for COs, and we're leaning towards not detailing those. So just to be clear, but someone is welcome to build a case here, but time is ticking. Interiors, we discussed the Peter felt bedrooms were defined, and we just discussed some of that a little bit ago. And he came up with the IRC's minimum definition. Doesn't include closets, Judith. But I don't know that we want to get there in code land. On Peter's comments on Allen immediate major repairs, he talked about the definition. Consider adding something. So Peter is recommending we consider adding to the definition of major defect. So that's our consideration, guys, until the next meeting, is do we want to mess with that or not? And appropriate persons, I think we're going to leave as it is. Peter rejects the concept that a home inspector could even get away with making a recommendation that he or she, as the home inspector, could further evaluate their own findings. That just sounds a little convoluted, doesn't it? Peter's comments on AFCI, GFCI's recommending we leave them as it is, as I'm reading this. COs where applicable. So required with the standpole. So Peter was in recommending we leave the panel covers in where they are. I'm not required to. It's not elegant, but it does get the job done. And on smokies and COs. There was just a little miscommunication there on inaccessibility, heating, accessories, and fireplaces. Yeah, no changes. Interiors. That gets back to kitchen appliances. I think we addressed that on the primary function. And we're going to leave secondary egress alone. Change on the rest of the kitchen. Very good. I think that is everything.
Yeah, it's all no change. It's all no change, no change, no change from Peter. Thank you, Peter.
So, we are going to take a look at a few of those items that we had mentioned here. And a little bit of wordsmithing. We're going to take a look at the major defect definition, see if anything is needed there. And I think we're going to stick with where applicable on the other one. So, not big on the changes side.
Is there a way to finish it today or not?
I don't know. I kind of I'm hesitant and not getting additional feedback from Mr. Elson. And again, in my opinion, I don't want to try to finalize something where there could be additional feedback that comes in a week or two from now. We're not at, I realize we're probably not going to get anything, but what if we voted on changes now? I'm leaning towards, you know, having the additional feedback from a committee member, but I'm open to suggestions.
Also, this is still open for the public to view as well at this point. Close it at the end of this month, right?
I believe the 14th of September is the final day of the meeting.
So still we got at least a week or 10 days to go, and someone could, you know, hit us with a big old thing.
We could.
This should be changed.
We would need to respond. So, I mean, I'm not. I think we need to. We put so much work into this. This is what I'm looking at is the kind of step across the finish line, and I don't want to rush it. Let's give it the gravity that it deserves, and I think we can do it within our time frame that we had discussed here. So I'd like to move on in our packet.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I did get a reply from the Secretary of State, and it does say that a rulemaking docket expires 1 year after publication of the proposed rulemaking if the agency does not submit a final rule to GERP within that time. The start date of that 1 year period is reset upon publication of a supplemental rulemaking. So I think we have plenty of time.
So it sounds like the 1 year will get reset when we submit the supplemental package. That's a good thing. Thank you. And I'd like to officially thank the Secretary of State. Get back to our agenda here, folks. We're going to need to take a short break here very soon. Is now a good time for you, Keith? All right. All right, let's take 10 minutes here. Let's be back by 11:15 sharp. Thank you. All right, it is 11:13. We are back in session for the Home Inspector Rule and Standards Committee. And looking at our agenda, we just completed a discussion of item 5A regarding our proposed rule and SOP changes. Agenda item 5B was a discussion on post-secondary education, and I believe that's one that will be tabled until, I guess the hope, Kurt, is maybe next meeting. This gentleman, Kevin, might be available, and we can have the discussion then, if that's possible, maybe in an October meeting.
That's correct.
Okay, so thank you. So we'll table agenda item 5B as a Baker. Let's take a look at 5C, home inspector certification requirements. And this is for regarding the education requirements. And let's just take just a moment to make sure we understand why we're looking at this. We understand from the 23 years of regulation in Arizona that obviously, it's easy for someone to file a complaint against an inspector, and a lot of moving parts on the home inspection. And while the law requires a certain training period, it's really not an apprenticeship program. It was never really meant to be an apprenticeship program. It was meant to set the bar at some very basic level. And that level included upfront education and included certain requirements for parallel inspections as part of an inspector's education. What we found is that the 84 hours of upfront education that is currently required is not serving the home buying consumer and very well, and even our new home inspectors coming in very well. The variety of education and the quality of the variety of education seems like it's all over the place. One of the areas that we felt was a big hole in the education was that an inspector could go through their 84-hour class and never see a copy of the standards of practice, and actually never be educated. I need a book to hold this button down. I guess it means I'm talking too much if my hand gets tired. But it was never meant to, let me back up. The standards of practice were not and are not currently part of the education process, and we feel that's been a big hole. And we feel that right up front, an inspector could be licensed and not really have a good working knowledge of the standards of practice. And so that was one area that, the more we looked at it, frankly, the more glaring, frankly, it appeared to many of us here in the profession. So that's a good reason to look at that. And we currently have a curriculum, not a curriculum, but a highlighted areas of study for our 84 hours. The thought is actually requiring study of the Arizona Standards of Practice within that. And that kind of led us through into making possible changes to the 84 hours. And when we consider just revamping 84 hours and taking an hour off of this and an hour off of that and just revamping it and including maybe some education on the standards of practice, I guess my feeling is that that might not get the attention of the education providers because it's still 84 hours, they're going to miss it. They're going to miss the nuance that, oh yeah, by the way, now there's 2 or 3 or 4 hours required to study the SOPs. But if we actually change the number of hours, even by 2, making it even 86, the idea is that that will be a substantial change, will get everyone's attention, and it may work along with some other possible changes, if any, that might be regarding the education providers. So with that preamble, I wanted to get your take, Kurt, on, you know, you bring so much of your vast education experience to the table here, and we so much appreciate that. And I know you had some thoughts on some of this, and I know, you know, John Elson also started to kind of piece together some possible curriculum thoughts on this.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I was tasked to put together from the last meeting some kind of an outline of a way of increasing the education for home inspectors. So in the packet, I've listed it as 5C on the agenda. And then I came up with just a proposal for home inspection schools, and this is just initial dialogue here, by the way. And just to be open, I do own a home inspection school, but it doesn't just affect me, it'll affect everybody. We'd all have to change, okay? So for One is Home Inspector Schools, the proposal for both classroom and online courses would be included in this. And all schools to be licensed with, I'd like to talk to Kevin about this, so we're gonna have to just wait, but this was the proposal have all schools to be licensed with Arizona State Board of Private Post-Secondary Education, online and classroom, both of them. And then in the handout here, BTR will provide the post-secondary R430. So we'll have to discuss that with Kevin. Okay. The second one was increase hours from 84 to 86 for training, classroom training and online. And those 2 hours would be used for report writing requirements to include the importance of and requirements of the work agreement, BTR checklist requirements, common report writing mistakes, and to review the required reporting item. And then also add the report writing to R430-247, which is the, you know, as structures, exterior, just adds another category that they have to study. And this is under L in the handout. And then for C, update R430-247 professional practice to include, they have to talk about BTR standards of practice as well as the AZ rules of professional conduct. So if you go to the next page, you can see R430-247, it's the whole description of that. It's home inspection certification 5, and what I've added is you can go down to L, add report writing, okay, and then also M, professional practice to include that BTR, SOG, and the rules of professional conduct. And then, do you want to talk about your rules at this point?
Hang on just a minute. I'm sorry. So the first component, just a moment on that, the Arizona State Board for Private Post-Secondary Education. Currently, some of the education providers that provide home inspection education are part or certified by this and some are not. And what does AZPPSC provide, what do they require for an educator? Can anyone give us any information on that as far as what hoops an educator might have to jump through?
So I really wish Kevin was here to elaborate on that, and obviously that would be much better, but to me, I'll tell you that one of the most important things is that they provide protection for the student. So I mean, this happens all, pick an industry. I mean, Kevin gave me an example recently of a particular tech industry that had collected $5,000 from about 30 students, and they all showed up for the first day of class, and nobody was there. But that particular industry he was talking about is one in the state that doesn't require registration with private post-secondary education. If you do, or if you are required of that, then you have to, that regulatory board, BPSC, becomes a certificate holder on your insurance, which, again, I don't want to go into too much depth because I don't want to get anything wrong, but I know it's based on, like, the tuition that's taken in. And anyway, long story short, is if something happens, the provider defaults in some way, the student has recourse to be made whole again.
So they, just to be clear, they are a regulatory body in Arizona.
Yes, for private post-secondary, so not, you know, like Arizona State University or public school, but the private ones.
Any other discussion on just requiring that of an education provider, that they must meet and conform with the regulations of that, that board?
Well, right now, all right, so currently online classes, all they've got two other agencies they can belong to, the national recognized, I don't know the terms.
Right,
do you have it?
Yeah, it is. So right now, as a reason rule, they have to be licensed by either Arizona Board of Private Public Secondary Education or accredited by the Distance Education Accrediting Commission or by an accrediting agency approved by the United States Department of Education.
Right. And if we go with Arizona Private Post-Secondary, it's state-specific. So everybody, all the online courses or traveling schools, they would have to comply with these requirements, which is very important to our inspector.
Great. If we did require this, we would certainly be losing some education providers, at least initially, on it.
Not necessarily. You could do a transitional period, right? You could say we've got 3 months these people can do that. This is the new rule. You wouldn't lose anybody.
I mean, I think checking with Julie recently, Julie, didn't you say there was about seven in schools in state currently, and a lot of that there's online offered too.
Yeah, so about seven currently licensed with PPSE, and I'm only aware of maybe two that are licensed or accredited by the other two options, one of them being InterNACHI, though, which is a big one.
Right, right, InterNACHI. But InterNACHI, certainly they could conform and apply for certification through the post-secondary. It sounds like the way it currently is written with the other two bodies, it's it leaves the door open to any kind of, in other words, there's no oversight on the quality of the education. And it sounds like it, I have heard some complaints, and maybe others have, on the quality of some of the education, I'm hearing from some folks that they're not learning anything.
Well, and just to kind of further elaborate a little bit, currently the way things are, and Ken LaMountain, the director of PPSE, has acknowledged this, that even in-state, we don't really have eyes on the curriculum. It's not really vetted by anybody. So I love peace proposals here, and I'm not opposed to say adding 2 hours, but I will say respectfully that adding any hours, whatever, isn't going to make any difference at all unless you can tighten the ability. You've got to create the ability because it doesn't really exist right now, but we could work with PPSE and do this where any curriculum would be vetted by this committee and would have to be board approved. So it's going to go through this committee. You're going to look at the curriculum. You're going to look at the hours, because you say you adopted what he's suggesting, and you add 2 hours and you include report writing. Okay, well, I'm going to open up a school and I'm going to spend however long I want on anything I want, and for 30 seconds I'm going to say, hey, report writing is important, and guess what, I'm good, because nobody's looking, nobody is approving and vetting the actual curriculum, what's going into it. So you really want to make a difference.
Yeah.
That's got to be part of your improved change.
I like that idea.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And I guess the bigger question is, how detailed do we want or need to be regarding reviewing of curriculum? You know, does it have to be a board-approved curriculum? That's the question. How much oversight do the educators warrant, I guess, as judged from their past actions?
They're going to ask for the outline. You know, how much time is spent on a certain subject, what are we covering, and that's what our job would be, is to determine what we think would be appropriate.
Well, the outline, I mean, that's in the rules, essentially, right?
Well, that's what, it's just subject matter right now.
Right, you really don't have any details. You just got a list of things that need to be covered, but no details or how it's being done or anything like that. And I'll point out that this is helpful to us here in the committee, that in statute, under the Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee, it grants you the ability, the committee is responsible for drafting and recommending to the board, number four says, standards of educational programs, including course of study, programs, and continuing education. So it's already in statute that this committee is set up to do that and then send it back to the board.
Right. Yeah, and I guess the question is, how much oversight should the schools have? Meaning, do they need to have their curriculum approved by the BTR? I guess that's the question.
Yeah.
Or by this committee, essentially, from what you just said.
Well, it would be, but it would be through the committee, or this committee would put together the outline. And then the post-secondary would make sure that they comply with that. It's from what I understand, but we need to talk together about that.
So I'm sensing we would have a little more of a developed, just more developed outline syllabus, if you will, on it, way more than we just have a list of 10 areas right now.
Yeah.
And something more developed that we could give the education providers that they could build off of to make sure that they're hitting the mark.
Well, it's not that I don't know that you would give something to the education providers. The education providers are already looking at this list. They should be building their curriculum and producing well-educated home inspectors. Yeah, producing what they do and for submission to the committee to review. And it should be, I mean, obviously their course outline, and I would think it would have like some time frames. I'm kind of comparing in my head to a previous situation when I was on a committee that reviewed all of the continuing education that came in before it was submitted to the board for approval. Not this board, a different board. And so they would review, the vendors would provide all the outline, the structure of the course, what, in fact, they would correlate it to specifically what area they were trying to accomplish, like does this cover ethics or whatever. So in this case, I would think they would look at the list and say this portion of the course will cover roofing and exterior surfaces or whatever, things like that.
From a legal standpoint, I would recommend perhaps looking at an analogous situation with ASU and U of A, where there may be a requirement for a certain degree that involve an English program. But the English program wouldn't be spelled out in terms of on day one you do this, on day two you do this. Rather, the universities would design curricula that would, in their minds, meet the requirement and then send that in for review. That would then be reviewed, and they could have entirely different curricula, but they would each meet the overall objectives. So I wouldn't necessarily design the course for the schools from a legal standpoint, but rather review what the school is doing to meet the board's existing criteria.
Yeah, that's a good point. We don't want to get too detailed in what we provide, but I think there's a, you know, I think back to what the Arizona Department of Real Estate requires when I submit a continuing ed course to them, because I teach realtors, and they require not only the entire class, but they require objectives, the outline and course outline, course objectives. Outline and objectives, you know, would probably be a minimum. So we'll see if there's any further discussion on this. I sure do like the idea of the post, Arizona post-secondary requirement. That sounds like it's really the right thing to do here. And it's also going to help our education issues that, you know, we talk about trying to address it at the front end with stipulating some standards and report writing in the curriculum. And if we can help
you know, with the quality and the content of that education, hopefully it will serve us well moving into the future. Keith, anything else on that before we move on?
Yeah, again, this is a starting point. Another thing I brought up was examination and other requirements for licensed inspectors. Right now, what I've put in here is, at this point, no continuing education. However, we would have a mandatory viewing of annual PTR review of items such as reviewing the violations, faulty reports and reasons, faulty inspection observation, new code items most recently implemented, and some ashy hot topic items, even though the ashy covers removed the whole state.
That's continuing education.
Okay. But it's not a... Okay. There would be no testing, but it would be continued. Okay, I got you.
Yeah, it's a good point, Keith, because certainly the BTR could benefit from imparting knowledge to the existing registrants. We either do continuing ed or we don't. And a mandatory viewing, it sounds like a good concept.
I got that up. There's no threat. I like that. Right?
So let's just hit this topic one more time. On continuing ed, right now, the current disciplines in the BTR, architects, engineers, there's no continuing ed there, is that correct? There's none anywhere in the BTR, is that correct?
That's correct, but totally does not matter if you want to propose continuing education with this profession. I think we have some good arguments to do it.
And we have the
ability
to do it, yeah. For the statute.
Because that's, that's a big road to go down. And it hits to the heart of, again, the education concerns back with inspectors. But
this would help address all those violations we have. I know it would really take care of that.
You know, I remember at the time, back 23 years ago, the then director of the BTR was a little less thrilled with the concept of it, but times change, and it's a lot more work for staff, right? So there's an impact on staff, and there's an impact on this committee having to then manage that curriculum, essentially, to some extent, and to manage the program. All the disciplinary action that would then follow with those not complying. And I'm just thinking about the ramifications. Not that it's not worthy of us, but I'm just trying to think this through a little bit. At the time we first got licensed, you know, the initial thought was that, you know, the local chapters providing education, and education is available in many places, and at the time, you know, the BTR didn't seem like we were really set up for it, because it wasn't done anywhere else. But if staff is open to it, I think we should at least give it some more consideration, serious consideration.
Frank Paul, what do you mean it wasn't done anywhere else? What wasn't done anywhere else?
Meaning that right now the architects and engineers within the regulated professions of the BTR, that's what I mean by anywhere else within the BTR realm.
You know, we are kind of an anomaly there, because most states do require it for all those professions. I honestly don't have the knowledge about home inspectors that nationally, how much that's required, but I can tell you with the other professions, it is mostly required in every other jurisdiction.
So has this come up on the architects and engineers and land surveyors committee discussions?
It comes up every time we go to national conferences, and they talk about it. But, you know,
again, apples and oranges because different industries, but I think that if the BTR were to implement it with the other professions, that it's, they're already doing it. So probably, I don't know, just be one more state they have to report it in. Does anybody know nationally about home inspectors? What if it's more common than uncommon to have continuing education?
Good question. It's for national legislative, we currently go with 35 states or so regulated. I think most of them that are regulated have some kind of continuing ed, but not all of them. And
I would say the thing with continuing education, to Keith's point where he said, you know, if we could do this, it could fix a lot of problems. I mean, I think you said it would, and I would say it could, depending on what the continuing education is, because there is a lot of garbage, useless continuing education available out there. So unless you're specific on what it is and it's meaningful and helpful, then it's not worth it.
You know, it's a really good point, and well, I'm sure it'd be an opportunity for education providers, but I know I take my 12 CEs for each year, my 12 hours for my pest applicator license with the Office of Pest Management, and I'm also a qualifying party, so I have an additional 6 hours to take there. Of the education that I can choose from, none of it, just about none of it, is relevant to a home inspector. So the Office of Pest Management, you know, for folks that are just inspecting for termites, they don't really have any real education for them. You go take some class on you know, injecting chemicals, you know, but it's nothing germane to what we're doing. So my point is that there's a fair amount of that out there on continuing education where you're just putting your hours in, you're just hitting enter on the keyboard, but you're not really functionally absorbing any knowledge. So that would be the challenge we would have, and that would probably be part and parcel working with the education providers to try to do something comprehensive or test out at the end of it or something. We'd have to do something that would be meaningful.
Well, and I think that I thought I addressed that because I think, you know, I looked over a lot of the violations, and a lot of this is just people just aren't aware of a lot of the stuff. So if we go with a review of topics, things that trip up these inspectors, new codes, Ashley's got all kinds of hot topics they can talk about. I think it's relevant. I really do.
Roger, where are you on this?
I think we ought to move into doing some kind of continuing education. I mean, a few hours to begin with, and then maybe more later on. I think it's a long time coming, actually, because, you know, most of the licensed states do require some kind of continuing education. Like Paul said, not all of them, but maybe 30 out of 36 might have some kind of education requirement. Yeah, it would help, you know, clean things up. You know, because I'm looking at our complaint record, which we haven't got to yet. You know, and how many inspectors have complaints about things? We need to bring that number down. I haven't got the intention of, you know, bring those numbers down. If we can't, you know, make less cases or have less complaints, that's a sense of
pursuing. And I feel like that's education based. That's why, to me, making sure the home inspectors are coming out of the gate with a good, you know, have good education and knowledge, in addition to the ones that have been out there for 20 years that occasionally get a complaint filed on them and come in and they're very upset. You know, I've been doing it like this for 20 years. Well, it doesn't mean you're doing it right for the last 20 years. You just got a complaint filed, and now you know. But so continuing education would catch that, and tighter initial education would help the guys first get started.
So,
yeah, I also being on the EAC, you know, what I'm seeing is that the conclusion is they are always the same. The work is not the standards. And that's what it boils down to. I mean, there's 84 items. I use that reference all the time. There's 84 items out there to look for. Not every house is going to have all 84 items. Nonetheless, that's what they're looking for. Even in my report, if I was scrutinizing, there might be one or two things that it doesn't quite be covered, you know, by the standards. I mean, it's hard. Writing a report in the state of Arizona is not an easy task. It really is. Make sure everything is in there. It's not all under the comments section. It's in other areas of the report as well. That's kind of interesting, as I'll find out.
I wanted to let the community know as well that Stephen von Ehrenkrupp is online. He's our home inspector assessor. He assesses applications, the barrel inspections that come in, as well as the initial assessments before going to EAC. If you guys have any questions or anything like that, I asked him to be on this one. He had an application recently that he spent quite a bit of time on that basically was just chicken scratch.
Yeah.
Very frustrating for him and staff receiving that. And knowing that we can't really hold the parallel inspector to the fire for that. So he's online for any questions or comments as well.
Steve, thank you so much for being online here. Did you have any general comments or thoughts about the topic we're discussing here?
I don't know. I think something definitely needs to be done. The reports that I'm getting from applicants now, it's common to see 15 or 30 deficiencies in them, and I think, you know, because somebody should be supervising that, the parallel. It looks to me like some of the parallel inspectors are just, you know, making their money and taking them along for the ride and then sending them off, and they're not really gaining anything from that. I would love to see some continuing education and the idea of having report writing become part of the class, or maybe even a separate class, I think would make a big difference in it.
Thank you, Steve, for your comments. How long have you been verifying or reviewing reports for the VTR?
I started about a year ago. I was first certified in 2000, I think, or 2021, I think. And I had an inspection company and volunteered for, I was on the EACs and I volunteered to assess reports. And then this opportunity came up and I got in with the VTR and I'm really enjoying what I'm doing for the most part. But like Kurt said, there's some of these reports are very frustrating.
Yeah, I'm sure, and we so appreciate your help with reviewing those reports. I know it's a bit of a thankless job. Let me ask you, Steve, how many of the reports have the report review checklist along with them that's being submitted along with the report that's requested?
Everybody supplies a checklist, and I don't look at any of them. They're pretty much useless. They have a bunch of numbers on them. Sometimes they just check the boxes where they're supposed to put a number, where they're, you know, page number or whatever, where they have that. So a lot of the times I don't even bother with that unless I'm really struggling with trying to find where they put something. Then I'll go back and take a look at that. But the checklist really doesn't help me much at all.
Okay, yeah, that's, I guess I'm a little surprised by it. Because I thought you might use it a little more as a reviewer if you're trying to find where the inspector, you know, had plumbing supports, you know, addressed or that kind of thing. But very much appreciate your comments and the good work.
Hey, another thing is he does so many of them. He's seen all the softwares. He probably doesn't need it. But somebody that doesn't do a lot of them is very beneficial.
Is Steve currently the only report verifier we have, or we have someone else also helping?
He's currently the only staff member. If we need to, we can still utilize the EAC volunteer pool.
That's great. Thank you. So it's good getting so good input from Steve, because he's looking at these reports every day. And just verifying that kind of the path we're on, we think, is the right path towards more education. More and better education, that seems to be the path that we're on here, more and better. And a lot of what we're doing is involved with that. So any further discussion on the 84-hour possible changes on the curriculum there regarding that key?
Well, no, I don't have any, but, you know, I'd like to just kind of push this on for the next few meetings, but I would be willing to put some kind of an outline together just for review on subject matter, and then see if you're in agreement with that at a subsequent meeting or something.
I think that makes a lot of sense, but something on the high-level side, you know, not too detailed, but something that maybe an education provider could build a class around. And frankly, if it's, I don't know that, you know, I'm married to an 86 or 88 hours. If everything, you know, can be accomplished in an additional two-hour module, that's fine. But I do feel strongly to kind of change the hour requirements for reasons already stated.
Right.
So, but yes, thank you. If you can give us a draft to look at, that might be the beginnings of where we're going to go with that. So, anything else on 5C agenda item? We're going to be tabling that till next time, along with 5B, that discussion on post-secondary discussion. Keith, on 5D, on parallel inspector requirements.
Can we table that too?
We certainly can. I know there was some meat and detail put in. I think it was from, I'm not sure if it was John or yours, that was detailed. But we have the challenge regarding what we can require of parallel inspectors, because they don't have an official legal designation. And so that's our challenge with the parallels. But it seems to me that if this committee is involved and in charge of education, can that not include requirements of the parallel inspector?
Ultimately, the problem is that the board would run into the same role that it does with the schools, in that the board doesn't regulate the schools, it doesn't regulate the parallel inspectors, it grants licenses. So the licensee may discover that the parallel inspector they used can't get them licensed, but we can't do anything about the parallel inspector. The licensee may find that the parallel inspector did not do what the licensee requires them to have done in order to get licensed, but that simply creates a cause of action for the licensee to perhaps sue the parallel inspector in civil court. We have no jurisdiction over them.
So if we were coming up with additional education requirements inside and outside of the initial 84 hours for licensing, that to require any education of a parallel inspector would not be an enforceable road then?
Right. That would be the same as telling a school that they have to have at least 10 instructors. You can't enforce anything like that. What you can do is say that an applicant has to have had 30 inspections performed by a apparel inspector who is a home inspector and who has not had, you know, a felony conviction in the last 5 years, and who has done this, that, and the other. And you say, and who is, you know, married and lives in Maricopa County and has 3 children. If you want to say that, I can't guarantee it's legal, but you, that would be what you could put on that end. The problem is, if the licensee applies and they don't meet that requirement, you can't do anything with the parallel inspector. You can just deny the licensee the license, and the licensee can sue the parallel inspector, but that doesn't get them licensed.
Okay, let's come around this from another angle here. If we had continuing education, there is nothing keeping us from providing continuing education on what a great parallel inspector looks like through our continuing education.
From a legal standpoint, the counter to that would be that the people who are getting continuing education are already licensed. They wouldn't need to know what a good parallel inspector looks like. They're not the ones you're worried about.
But we could do that.
Well, contraire, I think we are concerned about the existing inspectors out there. They're the teachers, they're the mentors, are they not? They're the ones that are bringing
in. They are home inspectors.
That's the point. But the instruction would also necessarily include the fact that you have no regulation over them.
It does go around and around,
but I think if we would table this parallel requirement, yeah, we would have Kevin here, and right, then we would see what kind of meat he had, or what kind of...
Yeah, thank
you. Kevin's going to say the exact same thing. That there's nothing that Kevin can add to the parallel inspection discussion. And if you want to add parallel inspector instruction in your course curriculum, that seems a little bit ridiculous, because now you're educating people that are, like, this is their brand new initial licensure, and you're wanting to make sure they understand that 3 years from now, after they've been licensed for 3 years, that they can, I don't know.
I do believe that there's a way to legally do it through continuing ed, do whatever disclosures we need to make sure everybody is comfortable with it, that you're not required to do this. But I think that's one way we would have, that's one avenue we would have without running a bill. So, you know, discussion, yeah, Kurt?
In some of our earlier discussions, when we were looking at all the different rules for home inspectors, maybe like a year ago or so, some proposed language was more about disciplining home inspectors for parallel inspection type of things. For instance, right now in our professional, the 301.01, you can get slapped on the wrist or you're in violation as a home inspector if you have more than 4 people on a parallel inspection. And so we had thought, why don't we, you know, add to that. So I think we had language such as, if you sign or affirm that you meet all the criteria to be a parallel inspector and that was done falsely, that is a violation, that we were gonna add that language to it. So at least if you are gonna, that's kind of a way to do it, not so much teaching them to be parallel inspectors, but if you're going to at least affirm that you meet the qualifications of a home inspector per the rule and you're falsified it, there should be some kind of violation there.
Have we ever taken a parallel inspector violation of their duties as a parallel? Have we ever come down legally on them with letters or whatever?
It just happened this last month. So it was, I think, the first time. But yeah, we have a signed consent agreement from an individual who, I don't know how to explain this, but
they give it license.
He basically didn't provide the services that was paid.
I hear a lot about these kinds of things, and sometimes when I'm interviewing inspectors and talk about some of the education. But thanks for bringing that up, because there is a certain responsibility of the parallel inspector. While it's not an official designation, but there's a certain responsibility. I know it's a little bit of a gray area that we have here, because we had to make some kind of designation on when someone is teaching another person. So it just came out. All right. Further discussion on the parallel.
Sorry, we did get a comment online here from Dylan Ducknavik. Are we able to create a separate parallel inspector course for anyone who wants to perform the parallels? It could be a great trial run on creating continuing education.
Of course, the Arizona chapter of ASHI could do it independently if they wanted to, I'm sure, right? There would be nothing limiting the local association from providing a class on that.
We're just going to include the Portland.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, no, of course.
That's part of it.
No, that's where the majority of this is coming from, is poorly written reports. Write a report that's going to meet all the standards and it's dropped and it's thrown out or whatever.
And for Dylan, this 5D is the regarding parallel inspector requirements. That's one I think we're going to just move it to the next meeting or whatever, and that's where I actually do have some ideas for a course, or training of some sort.
Okay, and so we, you talk about agenda item 5D.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. All right, so we will be kicking that back over also to the next agenda. Any other discussion on the parallel requirements? We're gonna keep them going here.
Mr. Chair, one thing I would like to point out, just as a minor digression, but as a footnote to the point made by the Assistant Director, Kurt Winter, the consent agreement that was involving a parallel inspector at the last board meeting did not have to do with a substance issue for parallel inspection. It had to do with a time issue on a requirement to return an inspection within a certain number of days. So it was not a substantive issue of the parallel inspector. So we did have jurisdiction in that circumstance. So I just want to make sure that was clear for the board.
Yeah, that was a good point, because it was a very specific time, returning the report, the time. Yeah, I understand. Thank you for clarifying the nature of that. Anything else on 5D? On agenda item 5E, updating the home inspector report checklist to review proposed rule changes. So we are going to defer this. There's no need to go through updating the checklist. We know it needs to be updated. We want to maintain and keep the checklist as a learning tool. I'm a little concerned that Steve, when he's reviewing reports, he doesn't use it that much. I would think that would make his job a little bit easier so he knew where everything was, but it's still a really, I think, a really good tool to make sure that these variety of reports we see, they all have to meet very basic standards. So we're going to wait until after our final changes on the SOPs before we go ahead and send out the task of updating the report checklist. Once we have everything nailed down, meeting, and I think we're going to have time to do that, it sounds like. Agenda item 5F, update the parallel log sheet to add a pool inspection column to ensure the applicant's parallel inspection reports includes a pool. Keith, it sounds like you.
It is, yeah. So, I just, for discussion, I'm just thinking that it might be appropriate to have, during the application process, when they draw from an inspection report from the 30 log, that maybe they would draw, they want to review an inspection report that has a pool, because by not doing that, we don't know if they're going to be reporting pools properly, and it's a huge safety issue, you know, in the inspection business and things like that.
It's optional. Pools and spas are optional, so it's unfortunate, but again, that's something else that's like a great idea. But I don't know how that could be enforced, and certainly anybody could turn in 30 parallels and never look at a pool, because they could do the next 1,000 inspections and not look at a pool. But if they do inspect a pool,
well, we have to train for pools. We give training for pools, so everybody's trained in it. So why not?
Everybody's not trained in it. I mean,
yes, they
that's
they don't
well,
have to perform them, but they have to be trained in.
Right, so we do have 4 hours in the curriculum on pull and spot, right? So
you're right.
So we do have that, but the real question is requiring it within one or more of the parallels. That's the real question, right?
Yeah, and I'm not saying really if it has to be required, but this would allow Julie's team to request an inspection that's got a pool. And then even if there isn't any, you're fine. But if there are a few, grab that one. And that way it will be reviewed and you're seeing that they're filling out everything that they need to fill out.
How often do you see the pool and spots come in on a parallel, Julie? I don't think I have.
That's because it's not required. And that's the only reason. If there's two separate, here's another way to do it. There's two separate checklists. If you combine the checklist into one, then you will have it all every time there's a pool. Maybe that's something I can say.
You know, we decided to keep the checklist separate because the standards were kept separate, is how that happened.
Standards are separate and it's optional.
Not under training. You have to teach pools.
So, you know, it's certainly worthy. The challenge would be trying to implement.
I think this is more of a convenience item for Julie's team here because honestly, and this is a safety issue, this is something that we should really look at. So you're going to have people getting licensed to be home inspectors who've never seen their pool inspection report. I mean, there could be barriers that are missed or, you know, some things like that, and it could harm the public.
Steve? Did you perform pool and spa inspections? I'm just kind of curious, as an assessor, what happens if an assessor doesn't do them? And then we ask him to assess the pool and spa when he hasn't done it. So Steve, have you done pool and spa inspections in the past?
You mean personally when I was doing inspections? Or?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Would you be comfortable assessing a pool and spa inspection?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I got one just a couple of days ago. Came in with a report. It doesn't happen very often. I've probably only seen 2 or possibly 3 of them in the years that I've been here. But I do have a couple.
Thanks, Steve. Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a good practice, Keith. It's just not something that we can require as the reality of it. You know, I agree that it is, I mean, the reason why we came to pools and spas after the fact was it was the biggest safety item, biggest ticket item, biggest hazard in the house, and we weren't looking at it. And we had no standards for that. And it was not serving the public very well. But,
well, is that something you should think about not incorporating? I'm going to open the calendars. Something basic in the standards of practice that just indicate whether or not there's a barrier if there's a pool present or something like that. Because I don't disagree with what you're saying either, Kate.
What prevents us from requiring the pool checklist to be filled during the review process? It's there. Everybody's got the checklist. So why can't you just say?
Because it's optional. So if it's not a required thing for them to do, you can't mandate that they turn one in.
Okay, but what I'm saying is if somebody does, if you put it on that inspection log and you've got a pool spa section and this property has a pool, you fill out your report and the pool report for the parallel inspector to evaluate, make sure they're doing it properly, and if that's drawn, they turn that in.
They can, if they choose to.
Perfect. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but what do you want us to do differently that would, I mean, if so, Steve just said he just looked at one and he's seen a few. So I think
what I'm saying is, all right, so for Julie's team, they look, they determine which one they want, what inspection report they want. If you have a column that says they check there's a pool there, that's in their report, now they can draw from that for the evaluation.
Just so I understand your clarification, you're not asking for for us to mandate somebody do a pool spa, but if they do a pool spa, they check the box, and then Julie staff can, if when they're doing their random selection, may choose one that has a pool spa to be assessed.
Thank you. That's it. Yeah.
And that's just more of a practice than anything.
The reason I brought it up is that they have to change the log, and that's, all you got to do is add a column and put it in there. That's why I brought it up. I just think it's a good consideration.
Any other thoughts on that?
Just from a process perspective, I think I would just need to clarify on the log, because a house could have a pool, but they may not have inspected it, right? It's not mandatory to. So someone may just interpret that as, yes, the house had a pool, not that I inspected the pool. So just to leave it in there.
It would probably just be a pool, yes or no.
If Julie's team is going out of her way to choose a report where somebody possibly did inspect a pool or spa, I mean, isn't there a potential there for creating different standards of review for these individuals?
And you're creating an opportunity for one individual to turn in, say, 5-10 page reports of just a standard home inspection, another individual to turn in 6 reports, 5 of them 10 page reports of standard home inspection, one of them a 6 page report or an 11 page report with a pool and spa analysis on it, and now you've opened them up to an extra section in which they might have errors or they may have issues, and where the other person didn't. So you can wind up in a situation where you do have people being evaluated differently, whereas they're going for the same license that does not require having that, the ability to evaluate that.
How about if we require everybody to fill out just that checklist, even if there's not a pool, just to make sure that they know how to do it?
It does get back to education in a way, but I'm kind of coming back to the thought of combining the checklists and combining the two to keep the pool, top of mind if we just combine the checklist. Did you have thoughts, David?
Just to give you a little historic, is the reason we went into the pool and spa business was because it was so prevalent in Phoenix and Tucson. We're doing it every day, so we needed to get involved. And then, however, there's other parts of the state where, we do require them to take the class, but they never intend to do pool and spa inspections because they'll not see enough of them to become competent at it. You lose technological information, over time. So
in my area, there's like 12 pools.
Yeah, exactly. So you're a perfect example.
And three of those are at hotels.
But the thing that we did was take a stand that if you're going to do a pool, we don't care if you do or not, but if you do, you're going to do them in accordance with these standards. So I don't see why we shouldn't, pick one that has a pool on it. If they're doing pool and spa inspections, as many in the major metros that are warm climates are doing, we should be able to evaluate them. We've got a checklist to evaluate it against. We've got a set of standards. I think it'd be remiss if we didn't do it.
We certainly don't want to avoid it. I guess the question is, do we want to encourage it by changing the checklist? That's really what we're talking about, changing the checklist. Is there a pull involved, yes or not? And then that may be the one or may not be the one that gets requested for review, I suppose, but at least one would know.
Or just report provided for a pool or spa, yes or no. And then they chose to do it. We know that. They've admitted it.
So we're just talking about essentially changing the checklist changing the parallel inspection form, excuse me, and then staff diligence is the rest of it. Any other thoughts?
I think this is a huge safety, and I honestly think we need to address this. This needs to be included somehow.
We could agendize it for the next board meeting to
do a little more research,
to discuss it and see what input or feedback we get from them. We could do that. Keith could take the lead on that.
That sounds like a plan. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that topic?
No, we beat it up.
We did sufficiently too. So we are going to take a quick 10-minute, and then we will come back and finish up our meeting. Start back at 12:25. Thank you. All right, we'll bring it back in order. I think we still have our quorum intact. And looking back on our agenda, certainly some good discussions here so far this morning. Well, Scott, I think you are up for your AAG training, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will see if I can be done in 7.5. This is going to be a very quick training. This has to do with jurisdiction, and this is brought up largely because I get questions from various committee and board members regarding the board's jurisdiction in areas. One of the big ones being expiration of a license, but additionally in other areas as well. So I'd like to touch base on this. This is a regulatory agency, and it only has the authority given it by the legislature, and it has the statutory authority to regulate in specific areas of practice, different professions. And it only has the ability to regulate within certain specifically designated areas of practice, and they are designated by statute. As we discussed a little bit earlier today, the statutes are the defining documents, and then the board can go through a rulemaking process to try to clarify statutes, but at the end of the day, the board only has the jurisdiction given by a statute, regardless of what any rule says. And in fact, if the board has a rule that expands a statute or artificially expands a statute, that rule loses in any contest. Additionally, boards can get into trouble where they attempt to expand their regulation beyond statutory requirements. There was a situation in North Carolina several years ago that had to do exactly with that, where a board was regulating, part of it was regulating in excess of their statutory authority. So where the board goes with jurisdiction is when a complaint, and this is almost always going to be in context of a complaint where I'm discussing the jurisdiction. When a complaint comes in, the first thing investigators will evaluate is whether or not the board has jurisdiction to review something. And it will ultimately go to either an EAC or persons to review it to see if it should go to an EAC. They may determine that it falls outside the board's regulatory jurisdiction, and the board may then dismiss it for lack of jurisdiction. Alternately, it could wind up going to an evaluator who looks at it and determines that the initial complaint said there were 5 problems with the home inspection. None of those 5 is a valid issue, and 3 of them aren't even within the board's jurisdiction, but I found 27 other things in the report. The question that comes up often is, does the board have jurisdiction in that? Because these were not items that were complained about by the consumer. The legal answer to that is 100% yes. The board has, in fact, specific statutory authority to open its own investigation. And this is where the board has an indication that there may have been a violation of board statutes and rules. If this happens, then the board has the authority to open up an investigation. So if a complaint comes in and it says that the inspector missed five things and it's evaluated and it's found those five things are in the report, but there were 27 other things, you can convene an EAC just to look at those 27 other things. You can convene one to look at the 27 plus the initial five. You can convene to look at any aspect of that. Legally, I wouldn't encourage looking at the entire thing, but anything that comes up at any point can be investigated. This means that a licensee may wind up receiving discipline for something that is found that had nothing to do with the initial complaint. Now, the reason for this, beyond just the jurisdiction issue, is that the purpose of the board is to perform a regulatory function. It is here to protect the public, and if it disciplines a licensee, that is a part of protecting the public. The other part of protecting the public is to, as you're looking at today, to educate, to try to ensure that the public is protected by having people out there who know what they're doing and are operating within licensing requirements. So to that end, the board has jurisdiction for anything that it sees that could constitute a violation of its statutes or rules. There's something else that a point that I wanted to make about jurisdiction that I think probably would have been phenomenally interesting, but it escapes me at the moment. So for the moment, I'd just like to ask if anybody has any questions about this, because this is one of the things that comes up quite frequently, especially the investigation and complaint process, and frequently with home inspections, because we get so many complaints where somebody makes a complaint to a home inspector, and the NEAC may determine that the initial complaint had no basis, but there are a bunch of technical violations or something else along those lines. So are there any questions about any aspect of that?
You know, I think we've known for a while that, you know, the whole report is under scrutiny when a complaint comes in. We probably don't remind our respondents, our registrants, often enough about it, but there are so many nuances in each report meeting our standards of practice. You know, there's a lot to do to make sure that we're conforming and complying, that it's not surprising that any report, mine, Rogers, Keith's, at any given day might have a small omission on it. So certainly not surprising. The point about the statute and rules obviously came back as we were discussing the definition of a home inspection is the statute. You need a piece of legislation to change that. But clarifying the rules. And again, we get back to the jurisdiction piece of it for the moment, where we will, it sounds like, continue to not accept high-rise condos on our parallel sheets.
Oh my God, are you still on that?
But that does get back to specific jurisdiction, right, where it's not clear that the BTR has jurisdiction in that area, so that's a good example, right, Scott?
As a matter of fact, that is something that has, it comes up across all boards at some point or another, and I've actually had this discussion with board members before in various boards, that there are times when something feels wrong. You know, you look at what somebody has done, and you say, you know, I can't put my finger on it, but there's a problem here. This guy did something wrong. We have to do something. From a legal perspective, that's entirely the opposite of how it should be, because if you can't put your finger on what's wrong, you have no legal basis for going after them. And it's important to look, you know, from the beginning and see what you actually have, make sure you have jurisdiction, and be able to identify a specific violation. And if you can't, there are a lot of situations where it looks squirmy. You know, there's something not quite right here. But that may be something better addressed in the civil realm. You know, somebody could file a lawsuit. It might be a criminal violation. It might be something for a prosecutor to look at. But it's always important to remember that the board is a regulatory board regulating simply the profession, and the standards and rules that are laid out are not aspirational. They are the minimum. And while you may want somebody, and you gentlemen are all very highly, you know, very highly respected and trained in your profession, and you have excellent, you know, credentials, and you may look at somebody and want them to hit a certain standard that you know is achievable, but the state can only regulate to the lowest possible standard for everybody. And as long as somebody hits that, that's as far as you can go with it. So, you know, with jurisdiction, it is critical to make sure that, you know, that you actually have a potential violation that falls within your regulatory parameters. But if not, it may be something appropriate for the civil or criminal law.
This guy, you brought up a great point. And I brought this up at the last meeting, firm registrations. It's just an example. What is, Orlean, what is the process when you do get a complaint? Where do you go from that? Do you go into the, whether they have a current license, whether their firm's registered, all that stuff? What kind of process?
Yes. So if we receive a complaint, I do the initial intake just to see what we have. If there's a contract, plans, or anything that has a firm name, I look them up to see if they're connected to the individual. If they are, and make sure that they're active. If not, then the part of the complaint would be that a firm issue. If the individual that's complaining, or the individual that becomes the respondent, works for a firm that's expired or not, then it would go to that principal, whoever's responsible.
So it opens a big can of worms there.
Correct.
I got one thing. What happens in the instance where there's no report available? Give me an example of a neighbor complained because they let, the dog wasn't let out by the inspector. Something like that. Or maybe that you trespass on my property. I shouldn't have been on that side of the fence or something like that. So what happens when there's no report available?
Well, every complaint that comes into a board has to be evaluated to some degree. So anything, any complaint that comes in, somebody says, you know, John you know, parked, he double parked in front of the house when he came to inspect it. That is going to be dismissed, but it still has to be, it still has to come in and be evaluated. It would then go to the board for dismissal for jurisdiction. We don't have any jurisdiction over how somebody parks. And that, well, that's not a violation of anything that they're licensed to do. So generally speaking, board staff can't dismiss complaints. The board is the only body that can take legal action. And so staff can look at the report, they can investigate the report, they can convene the EAC, and the EAC can make recommendations. Staff can take that to the board, but only the board can dismiss. So in that circumstance you're talking about, staff would put it on an agenda for the board to dismiss because it's not something that we, you know.
So what I'm hearing you say without board, it's going to be.
No, not necessarily. Just the items you were talking about were not items that we regulate.
Yeah. Yeah, I was there inspecting the house next door.
Oh.
Well, the neighbor's dog.
Well, let me ask you this. If a home inspector is inspecting a house next door and he lets the neighbor's dog out, is that a violation of professional standards? It'll probably get dismissed.
Okay, well, no, I'm just, I know
know, that's all.
Sure, oh, certainly.
I don't know how far I'm going in the neighbor's house.
Well, now you got a lawsuit possible. Yeah, see, and now you're into an area that I can't specifically answer because the board's going to have to interpret its statutes and rules and determine whether or not that is a violation by a home inspector. I'm guessing it's not, but...
That's funny. Roger was just asking for a friend.
Yeah.
That's good, Scott. It's good. Good reminders, and we need to be reminding all the inspectors in the state that every single thing on their report is under scrutiny or can be at any point in time. And whenever we're training anybody, it's really important because anything in the report is under scrutiny, and I don't think we can remind inspectors enough about that. Scott, did you have anything else?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Did you recall that one item?
You know, I think I'm going to save it for next time.
Let's see how the Steelers do first.
Yeah, all right.
Very good. Thank you, Scott. Much, and we are moving on to Judith and our director's report. It looks like you've got some really cool graphs and information here for us. Judith?
Really cool graphs and charts and pictures come from Hayden, manipulating all of the great data that I get from Julie and Ramin and then throwing it into pictures. So they're all amazing. So you can see, you know, as when this report was read, which was probably about a month ago, there was 945 active home inspectors, which make up about 2.8% of the total licensees at this board. And I think just talking about the complaints and what has jurisdiction, all the things Scott was just addressing, it's important to notice that one number that shows that, you know, nearly 50% of the complaints that come in ultimately end up getting dismissed. So, I always tell people, don't panic if someone files a complaint on you, you know. Because a lot of them are just, you know, not even founded. But I would say, to Roger's question that he posed to Scott, if I was an attorney, I would come right back at you and say, it depends. Right? He's laughing because he goes, well, it depends. Most likely, which is like words I hear a lot. So, I don't know, were there any other numbers that you wanted to talk about?
Judith, we're just looking at the charts, and of course, being analytical type inspector, we're always looking to see if there's any trends here that we should be aware of, whether they are, we see home inspector renewals process, that's going up year to year to year. We see the number of inspectors in the state kind of seems like it's hovering around 950 to 1,000, is that right?
Kind of stagnant, yeah, I don't think that's changed a lot. And the percentage of complaints has remained about the same, you know, around 30%, depending on the month.
So, and speaking of that, on the complaints for year 23, it looks like for all complaints received, the amount of complaints has gone up, it sounds like, just from looking at that complaints received chart. We don't know that there's anything, from home inspectors to the rest of the registrants. And I don't know if that's a functional economy or anything else or if it matters. But any comments on the number of complaints going up? I mean, it looks like it's gone up 30% or so.
Or other than causing early more heartburn. Do you have any comments or thoughts on that?
We did notice a big increase in complaints, and anybody in the public can file the complaints. I can't say that there's a trend as to, like home inspectors exactly, like, oh, they failed to report on a roof for five complaints or anything, but it just comes in waves and all for different reasons.
Why are you looking at me?
I feel like you had something to
No, but according to you got 184 complaints, but a lot of those were dismissed, right?
That's what Judy was talking about.
Yes, so...
So actually 40, right?
No, 40 were home inspectors.
Oh, that's 40 the home inspectors.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
40 home
inspectors. The others are total,
complaints.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's 184, there's been 184 filed for all registrants.
Yeah. Correct, it was about a 33% increase from the last fiscal year. And they all come as an alleged allegation, so then we go through the whole process, and then at the end the board would determine if that was an actual violation.
And Judith, the percentage of home inspector registrants versus percentage of HI complaints, I'm just trying to understand that chart a little bit with the red and the... if there's something... meaning on that one.
The meaning on that is just showing the percentage of complaints that come in to home inspector, you know, based on home inspectors versus the percentage that you make up in the overall licensees.
Okay,
so
but it doesn't.
You're like 2.8% of the licensing, but a large number of the complaints. Right?
But it doesn't mean that 32% of our registrants have been complained against over the last year. It does not mean that 32% of our registrants have had complaints, right?
No.
Good, thank you.
I think since I've been here, that number's stayed fairly consistent, you know, the percentages of, you know, licensees versus of the overall complaints that come in.
Yeah, we don't have any data on what the subject matter is of the complaints, right? It's got to be report writing.
A lot of it is missing. The report writing is a lot that I hear from EUCs. Yeah. Right, because, you know, I don't know if we can, maybe we can track what the initial complaint is that comes in, because a lot of times, you know what, that'd be a good percentage to know, actually. How often does the initial complaint, how often is it actually validated versus...
is what they find later.
Right, yeah. The report's looked at, and then it's like, no, it didn't have anything to do with the initial complaint. I mean, sometimes the complaints, the consumers, you know, confuse what they can complain about, the standards of practice.
Yeah, I mean, last I knew, last time I was on the AC, which was years ago, there's a complaint that comes in. Chances are, going to find something else on the report. Chances are, the rest of the report is not going to be pristine. Going to find something else on it. And I imagine that's a large majority of the time. When there's an additional items found in the report, one would guess.
And then there's a lot of variety there too, because it's how many things, you know, were missing or were incorrect on the report, and then the severity that's placed on what was found, because that can be really minimal or mind-numbingly severe, depending on the report.
I don't have any specific numbers, but I can say that initial allegation is usually not found. It's the additional information. Not that it doesn't happen, it's just not very common.
Do we have any kind of numbers at all on who is actually filing the complaint, whether it's the client, the agent, the seller? Do we have anything
on
that at all?
It's generally the client. A consumer. I mean, it's not, you're asking if real estate agents are filing all the complaints. I think that's an odd man out situation.
Yeah, it's usually the client. There is, here and there, you get the buyer, or excuse me, the seller, the realtor, but most of the time it's the client.
You know, it's early enough in the fiscal year, though. Let's see if we can create some tracking. I can't turn my neck far enough to look at Hayden. on the intake for home inspector complaints, what the initial complaint is. And yeah, we'll see if we can develop something and then have some data to share on that at the end of fiscal 24. Sounds more sooner.
Great, thank you. I appreciate all the work from the staff in combing through the complaints, and appreciate all your good work. All right, Judith, did you have anything else for us?
I could talk all day, but no, I think that's good.
All right. So I think we are on to the next agenda items here. We're on to the next agenda items here, I believe, future agenda items. All right, who's making notes? Hayden, is that you?
Yes.
All right, so we're hoping to have the gentleman from the AZPPSC,
Secondary Education, yes. In fact, I did just message him a minute ago, and I think that we should meet sooner rather than later, and I would even propose meeting Tuesday, October 3rd, possibly. If we do, it needs to be early, though, because our legal counsel has a hard stop that day at noon for another obligation, so maybe we could meet at 8 or 8:30 on Tuesday the 2nd. Sorry, the 3rd? The 3rd? Tuesday, October 3rd.
All right, so let's hit future meeting date now. Let's hit the future meeting date now here as we're backing into agenda items. One moment here.
You're good.
Bring up our calendars. October 3rd, huh?
You'd be good to tomorrow. Or even now.
Let's tentatively go for October 3rd and see if we can try to get what we need done there. And frankly, I'd almost like to start earlier, I think, just so we don't get jammed up. And I know there's traffic here, and it's hard for Roger to drive all that way south, but just in case we run long, I think I would like to start doing the 8 o'clock meeting, if you guys are all right with that. With an 8 o'clock start?
You can do it?
I know you're crazy about it.
I can look at the county rules because I feel like if you drive a certain number of miles away, we might be able to comp a hotel room for you the night, you know, before, so you don't have to drive as early. I can check into that if you want.
Still, it doesn't change. It changes the outcome for me.
If you're coming the night before instead?
Yeah. Still. Wake up in the morning.
It's too early.
Basically.
So gonna wake up. So let's try for October 3rd and.
Judith, I hear you, Judith. Thank you.
Yeah, but you don't know where she's going. Yeah. Right.
All right, so
that works.
So
Tuesday, October 3rd?
Let's go with that. I need to double check, but I think I'm good on that.
And I'm so sorry, did you say 8 or 9?
Let's try for 8 o'clock. Let's do an 8 o'clock unless someone can't make it. And future agenda items. So that's future meetings. Let's go to future agenda items. All right, so we talked about discussing the educator requirements and Arizona post-secondary certification, and we also want to discuss the 86-hour curriculum draft for the education requirements. Now, specifically, which rule are we talking about?
The standards of practice. I mean,
the SOPs, of course. Yeah. So, of course, the SOPs, the final, what we hope to be the final changes on the SOPs, of course. Let's put on there for now, Hayden, the pay-to-play definition, please. And see if we can carve out a little time to discuss that definition. Let's see what else. All right, what else for future agenda items? No, we certainly can if you.
No, it doesn't matter. I just I don't really see a lot. I mean, it's we did a lot today.
Yeah, I know.
And it's 12:30. I mean,
right.
We did a lot today.
Right.
We're just you could defer a lot of these stuff, a lot of this, and
just work on getting the SOPs done.
Yeah. And talk to Kevin.
And do a 9:30 meeting. Do it that way. I'm all right with that.
At least do 9.
All right, 9.
At least do 9. Okay.
Because I know the coffee won't be ready at 8. The door opens at 8, doesn't it?
All right. Let's go with a 9:00. I'm okay on that. But keeping in mind that we may not hit all the items on the agenda, and that's okay. But we need to make sure, and of course, first item on the agenda has to be the SOP changes and getting those nailed down. And if you want to keep the report review checklist on there, because we know we're going to have to direct that once we finalize the changes, I suppose. And what else for agenda items, folks?
You got it all. It's actually A, B. It's 5 A, B, C, D, and M. And then you're paid for it.
Right. How much time do you think Kevin needs? Do you have any feel for that? Does he need an hour and a half to do a presentation, or do we have any feel?
I think I would allow at least 30 minutes.
Great.
For discussion, really.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. All right. One other item. We have another member of this committee, Michael. And when was the last time he was able to attend? Do we know?
That's part of the reason I asked if we could do it on a Tuesday, because Wednesdays are never work with his schedule. So I don't know when's the last time. I don't know.
Okay. Because it sure would be nice to have all of our committee members here. And if a committee member continues to not be able to attend, then we may need to have a different committee member. Is Michael the public member?
No, Keith is the public member. And other than that, we're limited to the architect or the engineer, and Mike is the architect.
He
is very good, and our engineer is involved in so many other committees, so we're just kind of limited on who else the board member could be.
Got it.
So we may want to consider Tuesdays, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I just know Wednesdays don't work, so I'm hoping Tuesdays will be better.
Is that what the third is, a Tuesday? Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Any other future agenda items? Hearing none, we discuss future meeting 9 a.m. on October 3rd. Anyone have anything further to add? Hearing nothing, we will accept a motion to adjourn this meeting.
I make a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second that to adjourn the meeting.
All right, all those in favor say aye. Thank you all. We're adjourned 12:53. Thank you, folks.